This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Una delegación de estadounidenses. Ella sostiene que la situación del 1,5 millón de palestinos después del masivo asalto militar israelí es muy difícil y que continúa el cierre de todas las fronteras.
Es como la prisión más grande del mundo. Hay un bloqueo que los israelíes y yo diría también los americanos, que tienen una influencia muy grande sobre no solo Israel sino Egipto, tienen bloqueado las fronteras. Lo que está entrando es poco a través de formas legales, pero sí hay una serie de túneles, más de 1,500, donde están transportando los bienes en situaciones muy, muy peligrosas. Y hay muchos jóvenes, por no tener otra forma de ganar la vida, están trabajando en los túneles y están muriendo todos los días por lo peligroso que son. El George Mitchell, que es el envoy por la paz de Obama, no ha ido a Gaza. Y él está preparando para su segundo viaje al Medio Oriente. Tenemos que presionarle para que vaya a Gaza y habla con los que están en el poder, que es Hamas. No es que nos guste, que no nos guste Hamas. Tenemos que hablar con ellos porque son ellos que ganaron las elecciones y están en control.
La reconocida activista dice que a pesar de que el pueblo palestino entiende que Estados Unidos está financiando a Israel, esperan optimistas que la administración Obama cambie la situación en la región.
Es tan trágico ver la situación de los niños, de cuántos murieron, de los que están heridos, y luego ver que muchos de las armas que se usaron contra civiles son hechos en los Estados Unidos. Y sí, la gente de Gaza entiende muy bien que los Estados Unidos sí es culpable por mucho de la violencia contra ellos. A pesar de eso, tienen esperanza en Barack Obama. Ven la posibilidad de un cambio en la política de los Estados Unidos. Y por eso tenemos más responsabilidad que nunca de presionar la nueva administración de Obama de no tener la misma política de Bush, de estar siempre aprobando lo que hace Israel.
Medea Benjamin dice que una delegación del Código Rosa planea viajar a Gaza el 8 de marzo para celebrar el Día de la Mujer e invita a todas las personas interesadas en viajar a visitar su sitio codepinkalert.org. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a Telesur y a YBKM Mundial de Venezuela, a la Jornada de México y a la Radio de la ONU de Estados Unidos. A nombre de Matilde Rich, Rolando Solano, Otis MacLay y del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Well, you've been listening to the former experiment Informativo, which came to you on recording on WBAI. Now, tonight, the experiment kind of boiled over. Did you ever see that mad scientist in the movies with the bubbling Erlenmeyer flask? It kind of gets all over everything. They took a little more time than usual tonight, so I guess there might have been some people who missed their appointment with Radio Unnameable. But I hope they'll come wandering back before morning, which I guess it is morning now. Good morning, Cabal. My name's Bob Fass, and I have here two cultural historians who are weird shamanistic practitioners of the cinematographer's art. And one of them is someone whose work I have been, truly in fervent admiration of since I first caught a glimpse of a very badly damaged 16-millimeter print of it somewhere, I don't know where. And then one time, you might not like to hear this, Alfred Leslie, but I sneaked into the projection booth at the Cinematheque with a video camera, and I copied from the screen your movie, Pull My Daisy. Which, let me put your microphone on, which is, it might be that it is on now, it might be not. It, say a word or two, like, pull my daisy, light my light.
Pull my daisy, tip my cup, all my doors are open, cut my thoughts for coconuts, all my eggs are broken. Harp my heart song, harp my light. Seraphs hold me steady. Hit my angel, hype my light. Lay it on the needy.
That's
early morning in the universe. The whole world gets up in this loft that's in the Bowery on the Lower East Side. I remember the fucking thing.
Well, you can forget the station if you go on using that kind of unrestrained language. We have, it is not only a $250,000 fine, potentially, slip those terrible words of creativity. What strange animals we are, humans, that we can find our sounds that we ourselves can make that communicate with each other. We can find these words offensive. But there were now
you must have seen Lenny Bruce when he was alive, and you saw those great shows that he did, and that was all about that. And I won't repeat some of his routines, but they were
fantastic. Paul Cronin is here this morning. He is a filmmaker, and he's making a film about 1968, which was a bit after you made your film, in Colombia. And there were some words then that provoked...
up against the wall.
Right. For instance, a couple of weeks ago I spoke to Tom Newman, who was called up against, who was the author of a book called Up Against the Wall, Mother Bleepers. This is a phrase that was allegedly invented by the then Leroy Jones in a play.
But he took it from the police himself, didn't he?
Well,
this was the thing the police would say is they...
That's what I always imagined, but what it is in the play is a statement, a black man can't steal from a white man because what the white man has already been stolen. So, up against the wall, Mother Bleeper. Well, I'm dealing with that convention. This is WBAI in New York City. We are endeavoring to raise our usual quotient of need here. We have some people who are sitting in what we call the tally room, answering telephones at 209-2950. I have a message from the people who are trying to free Leonard Peltier, and maybe there'll be some people who saw Leonard Cohen at his tremendously pricey show at the Beacon tonight. So I hope we'll get some calls like that. Wavy Gravy has threatened, promised to call, because he wants to make an announcement about the upcoming memorial for Odetta. And yes, how do you do?
I don't really want to speak, but you should be informed that tally and fundraising for the overnights ended last night.
It did.
Yeah. What? So you're free just to do programming.
What a pity.
Enjoy one another's company.
What a pity. Well, okay. you want to pull up a chair, sit down, and
I've got a few things to.
Right. He's got better things to do.
Enjoy yourselves.
Adios. Oh, what a relief.
So you won't be raising any money tonight?
Well, hopefully what we'll be doing is encouraging people to go to our website and pledge unasked by the quality of the material that we're presenting. Pull my daisy and pull my finger, which is one way of thinking about what went on at Columbia in those days. The original difficulty was that Columbia was completely disregarding the existence of a community of people who lived around the university, and they were going to destroy what it was a kind of a commonly held playground in...
Well, destroy. They were planning to build
something
the gymnasium,
right,
which would essentially cut Morningside Park in half.
Right. And,
Morningside Park is not a big park.
And originally it was not going to be open to the community. Finally,
it would have limited access, right, as it were, by the community, yes.
Right. Well, one of the things that you can probably notice, Frank Leslie, I don't know whether you live in Alfred Leslie, I don't know whether you live in New York City or not.
But I've lived here all my life.
Ah, well, then you've seen.
I went to Katz's. The first time I went to Katz's was about 1937. And my dentist's great-grandfather was the man who brought over the recipe for the pastrami and started Katz's, actually. And then he sold the restaurant many years ago. But I used to go there in Katz's at about 5 in the morning. I worked with my first wife's father, and we cleaned floors at night. And then when we'd go down to Katz's and get something to eat, the guy sitting by the door, weighed about 200 pounds, take your ticket and go inside. So I know the neighborhood, and I know all the changes. The first film, one of the first films I made, was on the Yiddish Theater up and down on 2nd Avenue, around where I live now, that area between Houston Street and 14th Street.
Well, how did you go from cholesterol to cinematography?
Pastrami,
just for sure, why not?
Yeah, there's a little cholesterol in pastrami, no question. But how did you, like, you must have had a strong...
Yen?
It wasn't that simple in those days. There were very short camera loads of the lighting.
Oh, yeah, we had
16-millimeter
cameras, and we wound them up, Bell
and
Howell. Yeah,
film was
yeah.
expensive. And
No, it didn't seem that expensive. At that, by the time I was about 15 or 16
this
years
was
old,
1950,
it
was
40. Yeah. Yeah, well, the war was over in 1945, and a lot of the film that I was shooting then with my friend Tom Guarino was actually outdated or government film, war surplus film, that you could get very cheap. Tom was over in Germany. He sent over a couple of cameras that he was able to get. I would send him cartons of cigarettes, and he would trade them for camera equipment. He would send them back. You know, so I had stuff then. But that was it, you know.
And it wasn't unusual for there to be three or four different emulsion types used in a film.
Well, we shot with whatever we got.
Were you taking sound at all?
No, this is all silent.
All silent.
Yeah. And then, of course, at that time, Canal Street was the place where all the great failed businesses sold all of their stuff. And you can go in there and you could buy phenomenal 35mm, 16mm, 8mm, all kinds of material, films that were job from companies that had gone out of business. And one of the first collage films that I made, 1949 actually, which is called Magic Thinking, was made up of bits and pieces of 35, 16, and 8 millimeter films that we projected all at once together at a place called Studio 35.
With one projector or many?
No, three. No, there was a place on 11th Street, I think it was, right off around the corner from Hoffman School, from Hans Hoffman School, which is on 8th Street. And they sold old motion picture equipment, photography equipment, and I think Tom and I were able to buy for $10 or so a beautiful old 35mm projector. It ran. I think we cranked it by hand. But all of that stuff was around. It was up for grabs. It was like when they started tearing down all the restaurants here along the South Sea, Seaport, and this is recent, within the past 30 years, you could go out and they were throwing out these huge pieces of white milk glass that, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okie doke, that better?
That's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, white milk glass. Anyway, tell us more about your film. We were talking about it before because he knows David Shapiro. And David was the one who was photographed with the cigar.
There's an interesting... the story about the cigar is that... I mean, David's hysterical because, as he says, I interviewed him for the film, for the documentary. He says,
What is the name of your film, actually?
Well, it's at the moment it's called The Time to Stir, which is a paraphrasing Mr. Tom Paine. But the photo... In May 68, I forget the date, Life magazine... had a series of photos. This was a few weeks after the occupation of the university. There's a series of photos, including this, became this infamous shot of David Shapiro, who at the time was an undergraduate, maybe a sophomore, sitting at the desk of
the president
of the university, President Grayson Koch, smoking one of the president's cigars.
With his legs up on the table.
The shot itself, I'm sure one of the other shots, he's got his feet up, but I think the shot specifically is this medium shot of him glaring into the camera, glasses, moustache, holding a cigar. But the funny thing is, if you talk to David about this, he will explain to you that he didn't even smoke. He didn't even like cigarettes or cigars. But and as soon as the photo had been taken, he handed the cigar to someone behind him. And he said he was trying to going out of
Cuban.
It was a Cuban cigar, and it was the Kirk's.
He looked like Castro at that time.
He said he was trying to make a face of a kind of revolution. I mean, they were having fun. They were having fun.
And there
at least in front of the camera.
Allegedly on the wall behind them that they were quite worried about, wasn't there?
I think the painting... the painting was still there. There was a very expensive painting on the wall of the president's office, which the next morning, the police, if I remember rightly, the police came in. The students thought this was the bust and they were all going to get kicked out. And some of them jumped out the window. But all the police did was walk in and take the painting off the wall and then walk out. So, they were more interested in protecting art than protecting...
would that were so. That is not to say that what you were doing wasn't kind of transgressive in the time that you were doing it. The Jack Kerouac certainly the critical opinion on him was not unanimous, and there were newspapers who wrote about the Beats as though they were beasts. Allen Ginsberg was in your film. I believe Herbert Hunke is in your film. Herbert Hunke, and it's based on the life of Neil Cassady.
But what was lost along the way in many instances were the fact that all of them were artists, they were hardworking artists, and that issues of their reclaiming and their identity and asserting their identity, which was so important at the time, trumped over everything else that seemed to be going on in terms of their work, though eventually, and it was their work which held out everything.
Well, it was the kind of a ferment that a lot of people were going through at the time. Like in a Hollywood movie that was just shown, Revolutionary Road, you see people dreaming of going to Paris to find themselves, you know. And in a sense, failing as human beings because they don't go, even though it wasn't to be a writer or a painter, but just to experience a freer world than America in the 50s.
Well, I always thought many of the older painters and writers that I knew thought that the restrictions, in a sense, and the narrowness of the world that we lived in gave us the greatest freedom, because no one knew you existed. No one much cared that you existed. You were, in their eyes, powerless. And by appearing to be so powerless, you had great freedom. You could do what it is that you wanted to do without the burdens of the marketplace, without all the accoutrements of things that happen around you when you have some kind of success. Success at that time was thought to be, and I think still is, a burden for artists, a burden for anybody, certainly in the way that we think of success today, with all of the things that that come with it. You know, people lose their perspective on who they are and what their aims are and what their work was about. So one wanted to keep all that at bay, and the circumstances as it changed around painters at the time, the notoriety they got when Jackson, when Pollock was featured in Life magazine, he thought of it as a curse that had been put on his head.
Commodification of art.
Yeah, well, he was. People ridiculed him. They didn't understand what he was doing. They still don't understand what he was doing. That it was such a triumphant breakthrough, and he gave his life over to making that happen. But it wounded him tremendously, because at one point when he had the show, I think it was his early works, the early drip paintings, and he opened the review with Harris, said Poor was writing a review, I think it was in France, and they was Picasso was an idol of Jackson's, and the thought in one sense,
well,
that
Picasso was given kind of celebrity by Life magazine as well.
Yeah, well, they use them, but the thing was that for the artist, for another artist to be held up and used as a weapon against someone that you admired, that you weren't looking to dump or to cut the legs off or something like that, for something that was very painful. In other words, there was a culture of a desired community, and a sense of community that ultimately, I think, has gotten lost among a lot of young
artists. But you see, the critics are not part of that community.
No.
They're the guys who don't get picked for the team. Yeah.
Well, the community that existed on the street has been replaced, has started to be replaced in the 50s by the university. And the students were now, instead of being educated by other painters, were being educated by academics. And they were educated by people often of their same generation, only a couple of years older. And they were often being educated by people who had no experience professionally, as it were, in the practice of making. And so suddenly, over a period of time, 5 or 10 years, you get into the 60s and the 70s, a whole culture appeared that lost the resonance of community. And anthology film archives is one of the few places that holds the culture of the filmmakers being together and their community educating each other, rather than all coming from a university setting.
Are they particularly rare in this country? Are there many places in other cities where this kind of individual cinema is regarded and exhibited?
I think you can find, as it were, lesser versions. I don't want to say lesser. Anthology is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary historical institution. I mean, I can't say that I always want to see the films they show there, but I deeply respect what's going on inside that building. Yeah.
Well, they're doing a showing of your films all this weekend.
Well, he probably wouldn't like to see them.
I don't think you can assume that.
I'm curious to know, by the way, hopefully someone from NYU will call in and tell us what's going on at NYU.
Tonight?
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask Dan Strebel to be here
okay,
tonight.
Good.
Yeah.
You mean what's going on? Is there some sort of a...
There was last night at 10 o'clock, they occupied the building on the south side of Washington, of at least part of the building on the south side of Washington Square.
What was the occasion for that?
What was the occasion? They have a whole list of demands. Starting with amnesty.
For who?
For themselves.
For what they're doing.
For what they're doing.
Yeah.
All the way down to they want 13 scholarships for Palestinian students, which they claim is not an indiscriminate number. There were 13 Israelis killed, I think, during the last action, so that's why they chose the number 13. They posted their demands on the internet almost immediately, presumably from inside the buildings. But I'm curious to know what's happened today, if the police have, or if the NYU security have got rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's someone. We're going to get a call.
Good.
Because they have some demands.
Because in terms of community, I think that one of their demands is also that the local community have free access to the library, which I think is interesting and probably quite valid, because that library fills up such a huge part of that square. It seems, I've talked to people up at Columbia, and they don't have, the community doesn't have free access to the library up there.
Well, that's one of the things that's happened in the West Village, that NYU has colonized it. These are institutions that aren't taxed the way other institutions are, and they grab real estate. They become landlords. They evict tenants. They behave as anti. I don't know. New York used to be bohemia. There used to be rents that an art student could afford, but now, and NYU is one of the reasons that it's not any longer happening. Is that call coming in? I can go on.
Not yet. Not yet.
No.
But if it weren't NYU, would it not just be some other company, corporation, organization?
Well, they wouldn't have quite the advantages that NYU has in terms of freedom from taxes and I mean, they practically have the right to eminent domain in that area. Washington Square Park has been altered to their plan. There's a call now, Bill. That's probably
that's not.
It could also be. Hi there. No, they're not on the air.
Did they actually...
Hello?
Hi, Bob. It's Fred from upstate. It's an aberration. This will just be a quick call, just to let you know that it's an aberration because I don't normally see television, but a few minutes after 11 on the 11 o'clock news, the students were both outside the building and they were sending out photos, cell phone photos. So they're still there, and they're still firm in their demands. So
they're only in one part of one building, is that right?
That's what they said. Yes.
Okay.
They're right. Well, here are their demands: amnesty for all parties involved, full compensation for all employees whose jobs were disrupted during the course of the occupation, public release of NYU's annual budget and endowment. Now you're talking. Allow student workers, including teaching assistants, to collectively bargain. That's another pretty good demand. A fair labor contract for all NYU employees at home and abroad. Socially responsible finance committee that will immediately investigate war profiteers and the lifting of the Coca-Cola ban. Annual scholarships be provided for 13 Palestinian students. The university donate all excess supplies and materials in an effort to rebuild the University of Gaza. Tuition stabilization for all students, beginning with the class of 2012. What's wrong with the class of 2009? Tuition rates for each successive year will not exceed the rate of inflation. The university shall meet 100% of government-calculated student financial need. All right. I don't know, why should they have to leave that to the government? Why can't a student come in and say, look, I need $5 to... relax after a hectic week. You think I'm an idealist, a dreamer? You think I'm, being a student is not easy. It's hard work. The students are the working class. Student groups have priority when reserving space in the buildings owned or leased by New York University. Especially the Kimmel Center.
Which is where they're I think they're inside of the Kimmel, right?
That the general public have access to BOP's library. And what you can do is you can support the occupation inside or outside. They'll be inside all night. Send a letter to the administration in solidarity. Tell the world, send an email to your professors, peers, listservs, Facebook groups, etc. Talk to your friends. Those are pretty good demands. Now, we're going to get a call from Wavy Gravy, who came in after there was some disruptions in the 60s at NYU and staged a big event where there was an enormous vat of chocolate pudding in the middle of the floor, and people, some guy, he said, came to him and said, I have been to the center of the pudding. And NYU has been trying to send him bills for what happened to the basketball court floor with the chocolate pudding ever since. So
we We're getting a call from who?
Wavy.
No, but from someone from inside.
I believe so.
All right, it'd be interesting.
I can reach somebody if I don't hear from
what's
them.
Going on inside there.
Alfred, where did Alfred go?
I think he needed a cup of coffee.
We should be able to get him some coffee, shouldn't we?
Should be.
Yeah. You're on the air. Hi.
No.
Hello? No?
No one.
No one.
We'll call.
Well, you wanted to see if you could reach some people who might...
Well, I mean, I use this opportunity to just let anyone know that I'm always on the lookout for people who have first-hand stories of Columbia 68. If they were living up there, if they were on campus, if they were students, if they were friends of students, if they were... I've even interviewed parents of students. I've interviewed a couple hundred people so far. I've pulled out from archives thousands of photos, archive footage. Always interested in any photos anyone has. I mean, I can give my... I mean, I'm happy to give my phone number out. I can give my email out to people. But if people can get in touch with me, my name is Cronin, C-R-O-N-I-N, and my email is pauljcronin@gmail.com, paulj@gmail.com. Always useful to get more sides of the story. I've interviewed all sides of the story, from the students who are inside the buildings, the radical, the more radical students inside the buildings, through to the police who beat them up on the night of April 30th, and pretty much everyone in between.
Have you spoken to people who were from the neighborhood?
Peter Soto, who runs Morningside Books up on 114 and Broadway, put a sign in his window. And I've got some really interesting people calling who were living in the neighborhood.
And then there were theater artists, I think. The Living Theater went...
The Pageant Players were up there.
Yes,
we need to track down the Pageant Players.
Passion Players, I think.
Pageant.
Pageant.
Passion.
And
they were
Peter Schumann.
Peter Schumann, yeah.
And
The Living Theater... Allen Ginsberg was on campus. Of course, he was a graduate of Columbia College.
Yes.
He was on campus. I have some great photos of him on campus. Living Theatre. I don't think... I mean, to my knowledge, the Living Theatre guys were not on campus. But, you know, it was a focal point for those few days. Many people were up there. Just, I mean, before he died, I heard from Norman Mailer. He went up there. He said ostensibly just because his daughter Susan was at Barnard at the time. He wanted to see if she was all right. But it really was a magnet for many people of all different sorts.
People told me stories about bringing food up
right.
And throwing it over the...
Well, they would... I mean, the kids would sit on the... That of the ledges on Mathematics, which looked out onto Broadway, and Fairweather, which looked out onto Amsterdam, and lower buckets down, and people would drop food in.
And each of the different buildings had a different political character.
This is true. Shall I explain these? There were five buildings. One was exclusively full of African-American students, which really is maybe the most interesting and certainly strategically important issue to the whole thing. And there were four other buildings, I guess in varying degrees of political radicalness, as it were. Fairweather, which was mainly older graduate students, possibly slightly calmer in their political views. Avery, which was the architecture school, which was, as it were, occupied by accident almost, that architecture students were working there through the night anyway. So they figured we'll just close the door behind us and not let anyone in. Then you had Low Library, which was the president's office, which is the first white building, as it were, to be taken over.
Hamilton Hall was the first black.
Hamilton Hall was the first building, but the story is that about 18 hours after all the students piled into Hamilton, the black students asked the whites to leave.
That's right.
So the whites...
White students had trouble with that. There was
no question. Although they did all leave, but I think many of them were very upset. Very upset.
Dr. Kenneth Clark was there to, I think, mediate in part.
Kenneth Clark and Theodore Keel, who is still alive, who I talked to, were up there mediating for a couple of days. Keel came out with this great line. the faculty were grouped together inside philosophy, the philosophy building, and were meeting, and Keel went in and talked to them, and he said, in this room of, say, 300 faculty, he said, in any room of 300 faculty, there were at least 900 opinions, he said. Faculty, he said, really didn't know what they were doing. Kenneth Clark was up there. Kenneth Clark's son, Hilton, was a Columbia graduate, and Hilton Clark had actually set up, was one of the founding members of SAS, Students African American Society, which was, to a certain extent, the black, I wouldn't say black version of SDS, but it was a rallying point for many of the African American students on campus in the mid 60s. It's a hell of a story, Columbia 68.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, everybody. This is Monroe, Bob, and Alfred.
Actually, you
hey,
were...
Hey, Monroe, how are you?
You were there, weren't you?
That's so funny. I didn't have a preview that you were coming.
No, they only called me 2 hours ago to tell me to come up.
It's so funny because at our last meeting about 2 weeks ago,
yeah.
I was talking too much about WBAI.
That's funny, then here I am, yeah.
You should get Bob Fass into the film. Because I became aware of the Columbia insurgency through listening to After Midnight to his program, and I dare say Steve Post covered it. But the point is, I have to stress right from the get-go that the terrible condition that the United States and the world is in now, even with Abby Hoffman's great work and all the other people involved, the Columbia students, Mark Rudd and so forth, and Bill Sales and so forth, all these people were crying out against the establishment in the United States and at Columbia University. And the point is that this was a precursor of a warning that the country was in the hands of people who were inept to, shall we say, really fathom the new developments in the world, the need for better education.
What it made clear to most people was that the people who considered that they were in power were willing to brutalize people who were against the war.
Well, that's true, of course.
And that's really what the main overriding issue was. The students at Columbia wanted Columbia not to participate in what they called defense research.
Research, right. And then there was the draft that existed threatening the lives of students who wanted to pursue liberal education. But were forced, to be cannon fodder.
You're on the air, too. Monroe, what do you think of that guy?
Try to stress
Monroe.
Yes.
You're an advocate of free, unencumbered speech without any restrictions on it. What do you think of that guy and his insistence on calling up?
I think we should bring in Teokasin onto your program.
Well, I will.
Extend this chap's work, because he might be a part Indian, part Native American.
I think he's a Schmohawk.
Well, I know what you're saying, Bob, but when you speak about these people who are concerned about travel to Cuba, actually one of the, I don't know how to say it, I would say major needs that a lot of people in the United States feel is that we should change our policy towards Cuba and be brotherly and sisterly to the people there. And
very good. Monroe, call us again sometime. You're on the radio. Hello?
No, I mean,
Well, we have some sound artists with us.
That was,
cool. You're on the radio.
Yes. Am I on the, my name is Dr. Jack Block. I'm a professor of history at William Patterson University. And in 1968, I was very aware of the math department at Columbia. The guava bombs, you know, they were sensitivity bombs that were dropped on the people of Vietnam. And they picked up this urine, the smell of urine.
Guava?
That would go, yes, they were called guava bombs. And the sensitivity wires were going back to the math department at Columbia. And they would create the coordinates. And the drones, the pilot, you know, they would drop bombs wherever the urine was. And it didn't matter whether it was animals, older people, young people. They claimed it was Viet Cong. So I that was one of the major complaints that the kids had at Columbia. They didn't want to support the math department. And I was listening to the gentleman before, wanted to know more about, you know, people who knew about it and so on. And so I'm adding that for your knowledge. But it was disgusting. It was horrible to do that. And, of course, now we have... so many of these that are doing the same in Gaza and elsewhere. You know, I'm sure in Lebanon it was done too. So
I didn't know about the math department. There's certainly I interviewed a professor from the physics department, actually a Nobel Prize winning professor who was perfectly happy to talk about the work that he was doing, basically devising anti-personnel devices that would drop.
Was he with the Institute of Defense Analysis?
Well, this whole Institute for Defense Analysis, IDA thing, is frankly a bit of a gray area for me. It's unclear as to exactly who was part of the IDA, who was... It's not clear to me. This guy in particular was, yes.
Well,
His name is Leon Lederman. He's a very well-known physicist.
Well, do speak to some of the older staff at Columbia in the math department, if they will talk about it, because they were, as a matter of fact, even the New York Times had articles, so if you could do some research on the 1980s and the 68...
What do you do now, sir?
I teach Western Civ at William Patterson State University.
And is there any kind of research that's analogous to this that's going on where you teach?
Well, I mean, there are certainly in my department there are people very concerned about what's happening in the Middle East. But I think that what's going to be built up is a student a mass student protest. As they did with apartheid in South Africa, divesting. Now I don't know. I don't know if William Patterson has invested any money in, because it's a state university. I really don't have that knowledge, but I'm sure that this will grow.
I will look into the math department.
Right, please do. And listen, I enjoy everything about WBAI, and for those few people who do things that are disgusting, you know, I guess you have to just be strong enough to ignore that and realize that people like me have great respect for you. So,
there's a mathematical term for people like that.
Right.
Zero.
Well, you're 100%, and I'm with you, and... I hope everybody will support you and WBAI. That's all I can tell you right now, but do what you're doing. It's wonderful.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I doubt that that's all you can tell us. I'm sure you could tell us plenty, but thanks very much.
And take care. You bye.
Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, you are on the radio.
May God bless you. Your program is excellent. Granted, many white American folks voted for Obama, but our community worked our hearts out. What can we do to help Obama protect himself from making Afghanistan his Vietnam? Thank you.
I think that you have to... say that in as many venues as possible. I think this is probably, for a while anyway, going to be an accessible White House. I think that there are probably telephone numbers you can call to express your feelings. 17,000 troops is that's a lot of troops.
But I would want to count on venues like yours, because one, you're altruistic, you are media savvy. The people surrounding him in the White House, when we call, most of what we say may not reach him. In all fairness.
Well, maybe, but it might be a little different this time. But I don't know. One thing you can do if you have a computer is go back to a site that they're calling Take Back NYU, where there's a what looks like a real-time video stream of students in, I don't know what building it is, turn on the audio, people are saying. Protesters in America are nowhere near as sexy as in Greece. Well, people are getting right to the essentials. Am I to leave? That's dumb talk. 10 just left, and someone is looking right at the camera saying, "Hi there. Hi there." I wonder if they're listening to us.
Hope so.
Anyway, this is a new postmodern kind of university takeover, don't you think?
Yes, I still, however, believe that institutions like yours can indeed be very influential in propelling this idea. What will Harlem gain from war in Afghanistan? What will Watts, what will Howard University gain? What will his children gain? What will America really gain in killing Afghans and young Americans dying? The French have been there. The Russians have been there. History tells us over and over again. We cannot make people who are right-handed to be left-handed, for God's sake. Afghanistan has never attacked us in America, and most likely left alone will never attack us. What's the sense?
Well, I'm sure you're not expecting anyone here to argue with you. I think you're saying it very well and very movingly, and I thank you.
And perhaps like Dr. King, media set up like yours should not be afraid to beat the drum of truth, to beat the drum of sensibleness.
That's a good idea for WBAI. Let's beat the drum of truth. Very good.
And send some money.
Very good. That, I think if Sydney's listening, you've got a slogan for a T-shirt.
And a drum while you're at it.
Thank you very much.
We will send more money. God bless you.
What's your name, sir? Don't want to give it, huh? Well, that's called standing up.
Did he give it as a professor, or was that another?
No, that was the other guy.
Hi, you're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, Bob. Yeah, I heard you. It sounded like you were playing recording, but that one day was me stuttering when you cut off before.
I heard it. I heard it sounded like your voice. Now, who are you?
I'm surprised you recognize it. I don't know how old that cord is, but I got some help with the stutter anyway.
Who are you? What's your name?
My name's Brent.
Brent, you have problems with stuttering. Everyone stutters a little bit,
Yeah, I'm too embarrassed to talk about it. I'm too embarrassed to talk about it, even over the phone. So I'm going I got some help for that anyway, so.
Well, I appreciate it. I thank you very much.
Well, okay, I want to ask you about this picture on the New York Post.
It's disgusting. There's nothing left to be said about it. It was clearly like the worst kind of immature. The best you can say for it is that it's immature and it's childish and it's stupid. And the worst you can say for it is really pretty terrible.
Right, because the New York Post, they has come like that before. I mean, some not like that, but...
Yeah, that's racist, right. That guy commonly does things that are borderline racist, at least.
Yeah, you know, cause I think the artist really... I mean, he doesn't really get the point, you know. I think he gets the point.
And he's delighted that he's getting worldwide attention as a schmuck now.
He could have said that, you know, I wasn't referring to Obama, he's not referring to Obama. He least could have put a different perspective, but, you know, a lot of people, they took it very seriously, you know, I don't read your post, but, you know, I happen to, like, you know, just flip through it, you know, I seen some racist comments about, you know, like, even when, like, George Bush, they had a lot of stuff about Bush, you know, making fun of him, drawing a picture of him, but, somehow, you know, I thought it was just talking about, you know, when the Tremaine got shot, you know, but I mean, really shot when I read the quote, you know, what it says, you have to find somebody pay Simmons' bill.
Look, you know, the poor chimpanzee and the poor woman who may have a slightly longer life in the public media because she's getting a new face. These are all distractions. These are all distractions. This is the Joey Buttafuoco school of taking the attention away from where it really ought to be. I'm going to go on to another call.
All right.
Bye-bye. Take care. And you're on the radio. And it's you. Hello?
You know what it's time for? A sexy party.
Did he say what it's time for is a sexy party?
Yeah, that sounds great.
That sounds great. I hope that's what's going on at NYU right now. You know, are there things like sexual liberation leagues in schools today?
Golly, I don't know. Yes, of course, it must be. One of the guys I talked to for the 68 project, he was very interesting. He said the whole 68 thing was nothing. The most frightening thing I ever did was at the age of 19, I think in the fall of 68, he said it was certainly his first gay, sort of Columbia gay and lesbian student meeting. If it was not the first Columbia one, it was certainly his first one. He said it was it was much more frightening than anything he did on campus in 68. You know.
Well, you know, being that age is about walking on that razor edge of what you're scared of and trying to see what you can, you know, your own limits. So a lot of experimentation went on in those days.
They were very brave. I mean, we forget that these men and women were basically 20 years old.
Yeah, that's
20
right.
years old. And some of them were startlingly smart. I mean, it's extraordinary how eloquent they are, both when one listens to the radio broadcasts, the interviews from Pacifica back in 68, one reads the things they were writing, not least the book that was published the following year, which was written by 21, 22-year-old students. It's extraordinarily smart stuff.
It was pre-Stonewall, too. So there was a lot more abuse that was tolerated by those being abused.
Sure, Stonewall was 69, right? But
yes.
Which, the fall of 69?
I think so. It was 69, for sure.
But just generally, those Columbia students were really very smart. Some of them were very, very smart. And still are.
They're too smart to call tonight to reminisce about those days. I guess. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Bob. Can I talk to Mr. Leslie for a little bit?
You'll have to follow him home. He left.
Oh, okay. All right. Next time, then.
You want to say something about him? Because,
I just wanted to talk to him about paintings. But since he's not there, it's, but you like cats, right, Mr. Bob?
Mr. Bob.
No, I'm sorry.
You can call me Bob. Yeah, I don't know whether I like them or not. I think I know too much about them to really like them.
Then why did they lick your face? When I'm on the bed, like, my cat comes to lick my face, does that mean he likes me or something?
It might mean that there's salt on your face.
That could be it. Well, oh, it's too bad Mr. Leslie left.
You're a painter, huh?
Yeah,
it is too. It is too bad. He said it was some sort of a family emergency.
Oh.
And
his films are at Anthology tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah, tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7:30.
Started tonight, he said.
Yeah.
There was a screening tonight.
The titles of them are Pull My Daisy, which is the only one I've seen. The Last Clean Shirt.
With Pull My Daisy, I'm kind of confused whether he was the cinematographer or Robert Frank was the cinematographer.
Well, he was the director, I think.
Oh,
Robert
the
Frank
director.
I think they're both. I think they're co-credit. Get co-credit as directors, aren't they? I haven't seen the film in a long time.
He's about the same age as Robert Frank, or?
He said he was 82.
Oh, okay, that's very good.
He was talking about, was it in the Merchant Marines during the war, he said?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think our news has an article about him. Maybe it was,
He certainly doesn't look 82, does he?
Hmm.
He's in pretty good shape.
Quite spry.
I think it's kind of, maybe this month or last month, Art News. I sort of looked over it at the library, and it's about his paintings. So we can. But you know, it's unfortunate. He left. Did you say he had an emergency or?
That's what he told us. I mean, who knows what the truth was. Speaking of not knowing what the truth is, this is WBAI in New York City.
Oh, okay.
We're also being heard over KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, and over
Alaska.
CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, as well as streaming on the World Wide Web. And in less than half an hour, we'll be joined by WJFF. In Jefferson, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. Keep listening.
Okay. All right, Bob.
And get over to Anthology to see those films.
Okay. All right. Have a good day. Bye.
Bob, maybe you want to give out the coordinates of the theater.
Second and Second. Second Street and Second Avenue.
That's pretty easy.
Yeah. Maybe Alfred's going to be there one night. It might say in the Anthology brochure.
Mm. Well, he wasn't there tonight.
No, but he said
he came here.
He said he was saving it up
and
for tonight.
And then he left.
But he lives in the neighborhoods, I think. So I would be surprised if he didn't stop by one evening.
You're on the radio.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
Okay.
Wanted to know if Mr. Cronin, I didn't catch the entire talk by Mr. Cronin, but I know that
he's
he
still the entire
Paul,
talk
Paul,
is
call me Paul.
Still in progress.
Okay, Paul. I know that you made some mention about the black students in Hamilton Hall and asking the white students to leave. But I didn't know if you had prefaced that with the entire story about the black students and about the gym being built in Morningside Park. Might have said that.
We didn't really. We touched on it. We haven't really talked about the history of it at all. No, but you're absolutely right to bring it up.
There were absolutely valid. Because I think you can't tell the whole story.
Oh, no, there were absolutely valid reasons. And many of the white students absolutely recognized that it was the right thing to do. it was the right thing to do for
them
to leave Hamilton
Hall. We discussed the gym, and we discussed the fact that originally the community in which the gym was built was not going to be allowed access to the gym.
I didn't want to suggest that there was some, you know, the black SAS students just woke up that morning and decided indiscriminately to get rid of the white students. Far from it. Far from it.
And also there was the disciplined arrest.
Absolutely. On the other end. Yes. Absolutely. The
which couldn't have happened if...
Black students were let out of Hamilton Hall in a disciplined, quiet manner. Well, were you there? Were you there?
I actually was not there. Okay. I am a graduate of Columbia, but I actually was a high school senior at the time of the strike.
Did you want, what's interesting is that I talked to a couple of people who were in high school at the time. Everyone flocked to campus, as it were.
Yes.
From high school students.
I tried to get up on the campus, of course, but the campus was all locked up, of course.
Right. Now, Hamilton Hall is the key to understanding Columbia 68 strategically. The fact is that the administration, which is essentially to say the police, probably almost certainly would have moved in a lot earlier if there hadn't been an all-black building on campus. There was the feeling that one gets when one talks to people, whether they be faculty, students, there was a fear of, I mean, one has to understand this is 3 weeks after King has been killed. This is only 3 weeks after Martin Luther King has been assassinated. So there's a fear on the campus that if they mess with the black students in Hamilton, then Harlem is going to come up, walk through Morningside Park, and occupy the campus. Now, I've talked to some of the black students, and they've downplayed this. But if one looks at the press at the time, if one looks at the primary material, there is this feeling, it seems to me, in the air of worry that Harlem is an issue. Harlem is an issue.
Certainly, and I think that it's only fair to mention that there is a short film that one of our Barnard Black graduates made.
Sherry Suttles. Yeah. I think.
Called Vala, yes.
Now, is it available? Is it?
I believe it is available.
There are some clips on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and type in Vala, or I guess just Google, her son's name is Kamau, K-A-M-A-U, I believe it is. If you Google those, I'm sure you'll get reference to it. I think it played at a film festival last month.
You know, in line with what you said, do you remember a song by Country Joe and the Fish?
One.
That had the lines in it, exotic Harlem, come visit Harlem, or Harlem will come to you.
See colorful Harlem.
Right.
In New York City.
Yeah, right. Go ahead, Bill. That's great. You're an angel. You can sing like an angel, Bill. You should have had a career in opera.
That was
okay,
music.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that. Bye.
I remember at the time, they were saying that geographically, Columbia looked down, literally and figuratively, on the community.
Well, right. I mean, there's a topographical unfortunately, it's true. One goes to Morningside. I mean, I happen to live on 119 and Morningside Drive, and my apartment literally looks out over this precipice. It is a precipice. It's a drop on the west side of Morningside Park.
They don't call it the Heights for nothing.
Exactly right.
You're on the air.
Hi, this is Cloudy. And that's true about Morningside Park. It is like a kind of buffer zone for the university. Mm.
Interesting, there's a security guard that walks up and down Morningside Drive from about 113 to 118 all night. One just gets the sense that they're always expecting Harlem to walk up through Morningside Park. It's funny. I see the poor schmuck who has to walk up and down in the cold.
The little alcoves on the street seem like the turrets of a castle.
That's right, yeah.
I just wanted to first also to express my solidarity with the strikers at NYU. And they're putting out, there's a petition out on the web, and also ways that you can contact by email or better yet by telephone the president of the university and the provost in support of the strikers. Apparently they've just started, they've acceded to some kind of negotiation since midnight. But I don't know anything about what.
You know, I just want to say one of the, my gut sense when I read the demands online, I mean, the first thing I just thought was the amnesty thing should have come last. To put the amnesty thing first, I think was a bit of a misjudgment. I think to emphasize that, to emphasize the call for amnesty was slightly misguided.
I think it was last at Attica. I might be wrong, but that's the one thing that was the stickling point, which sent in Rockefeller's stormtrooper. 71.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a problem. It's almost always included in the demand. One tweak that I had thought about, they have a lot of the demands are for basically transparency institutionally, which are, which is something basic that the university should just give in, I can't, with before even the strike ends. To not have that is unconscionable, but they have demands for student representation on the Board of Trustees dealing with investments. You can't leave out the faculty when you're talking about a democratic restructuring of university.
Well, is there anything like a Senate at NYU? Because I'm looking at the moment, the 40th anniversary of the establishment of the Senate at Columbia is coming up. One looks in the archives, it's extraordinary, on May the 1st, literally hours after they're still scrubbing the blood off the Columbia campus. People are meeting to discuss the restructuring of the university and ultimately what became the Senate in the fall. Is there such a thing at NYU? Any kind of representative
all
structure?
All the leading universities have some kind of collectivity of the faculty. But that the faculty collectivity does not have generally representation, let alone substantial representation on the board. And over the period of decades and generations, the power of the administration relative to the faculty has increased. And so there's this, like, corporate centralization. I know the Harvard Board of Overseers, which has only about 8 people on it, when one dies or resigns, they're replaced by the other members. It's a self-sustaining board.
They only
seek input.
Do we not have to distinguish between? Am I on? Do we have to distinguish between the Board of Trustees and a more general representative body that takes in faculty, students, workers, even local residents? I mean, are the students really going to get a say on the Board of Trustees?
It's unlikely that they'll get a major say.
It has happened at some schools as a result of things.
I mean, it's interesting, at Columbia in 68, some of the more radical groups, student groups, who were trying to put in place a viable restructuring process, they were very anxious that local Morningside Park residents would have a say on what became the Senate.
You're on the air. Hello. And you're on the air.
I'm still finding my...
You lost. No. And now you're on the air. Could be you. On the air. Hello?
Yeah. My name is Estela, and I called it another time. I don't know if you remember, I recommend you read the book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. Sally O'Brien offered 2 weeks ago or last week, and you made a comment about this book. I recommend this.
Is it relevant to what we're talking about this morning?
No, I didn't listen this morning.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you telling me that, because I don't, you know, entertain calls from people who are calling up to,
But she read also.
Call during her program. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
patience is virtue. I've been calling for the last hour, and I see those monkeys getting in, and I'm still buzzing. My phone was still ringing. Anyway, this is a very good topic. And I remember back in the 60s or the 70s, when they had that university riot in Canada.
In Canada?
Yes, where a Guyanese was suspended from the college, and he went back home, became a politician, but he was killed by the powers of B. They put the bomb into a shortwave radio. And when he turned it on, he was blown to pieces. See? So these colleges need to not only collect the fees from the students, but look after their interests more adequately. I'm appalled at the housing situation in the colleges. Some of them are like hotels. Some of them are like liquor restaurants. They drink heavily on campus. They do everything heavily on campus. And even though they have a security coming around, the security seem not to be able to handle the situation, or they encourage it. Those are little things that need to be addressed if you want the university
well,
to
Well, you know, students are not monks. There's... They're in school trying to test the limits of what they can, in some cases, anyway, trying to test the limits of their mind,
oh, yes.
The limits of their body, the limits of their senses.
Everything.
Everything, you know.
I've attended about 3 colleges in several countries,
uh-huh.
And I know what you're talking about. I heard a little talk just... about an hour ago about gays. In one college, we had 4 boys to a room. We had a bathroom with 2 showers and 4 sinks. So 6 of us in the bathroom at a time. And there were no faggots in that dorm.
You're aware that some people take that description of... their sexual preferences as offensive.
Mm.
Are you aware of that?
Yes.
And so you don't mind offending them?
I am not for it. I'm not against it. The choice is theirs. The choice.
Right, but what? So, but in that case, wouldn't it be better to use a more neutral, less insulting word?
That choice.
No, not than choice. You said faggots.
Oh, well, I heard the discussion just now.
I mean, some people use it as a term of science.
But no one mentioned the word faggot here.
Whatever. It meant what I, you know. But all the boys in that dorm were thinking of how to get down in the girls' department, you know. We wanted to share the wealth. But, I love your program, and keep the good work up. May WBAI live forever. Bye.
Thank you. You're on the radio. I think he swallowed his tongue. You're on the air. Oh, he has 2 telephones. You're on the air. You're on the air.
Hello, Bob.
Hello.
This is David, the art guard. I called you last week.
Oh, hi.
And I failed to mention I'm also an artist. And I heard that you're talking about universities and the last caller... Well, I'll say a prayer for him. Anyway, my daughter is 18, and she's going to college. She's up at Purchase. And the last caller was talking about how schools are party schools. Well, I liked what you said about how kids are testing their limits and they're trying to grow up. That's what I think my daughter's doing, you know. I studied art in Dayton, Ohio in 64 to 1968. And it was very close to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I was a kid from the cornfields at that time, very naive, and when I went to art school, it was a great education for me. And I'm grateful that I found art because it saved my life in many ways over the decades, and I still do it. And I work as an art guard to support my art habit. I studied from 64 to 68. My tuition was, if I remember correctly, $300 per semester.
And what is it now for your daughter?
about $3,500.
Wow.
And that's a
state school.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. So she's trying to transfer to Cooper Union and maybe FIT. Now, I read in the New York Times that Cooper Union has...
There are going to be some Pell Grants, you know, in this new stimulus package.
Uh-huh.
There are going to be some money available for students.
Well, thank you for telling me that, yes. I just want to say I love your program, and I greatly appreciate... I don't know any other radio station that tells the truth that you folks do, and I tell other people to listen to it now and then, and sometimes they even listen. And by the way, I think I qualify to talk about Columbia because when I first came to New York, this was back in, when I moved to New York, it was 83, I had a girlfriend who had gone to Barnard, so that may qualify me to talk about Columbia.
I'm just curious, you say your school was near an Air Force base. I mean, was...
Yes, this was 1964 through 68.
So this is clearly a moment when, I mean, were there clashes between, I mean, did you have any contact with the anyone on the base, or was it totally...
Probably there were ROTC students.
That was UD, which was University of Dayton. There was, as far as I know, but we were the art students at Dayton Art Institute. It was very small, and it was not affiliated with the U of D. So we only got a diploma. We did not get a degree. So... But what happened was there were a handful of students that marched along the perimeter of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was, at that time, the largest Air Force base in the U.S. And there were B-52s, camouflage B-52s, lined up not far from the street. And you could drive along the outer perimeter of the public access road. And you could see those B-52s with those heavy wings and those big jet engines pulling them down, and you could just imagine what they were doing, you know. But I was a kid, and I was politically unconscious at the time, and I needed the education that I got, and I'm grateful to have gotten it.
Well, you know, I talked to a lot of the Columbia students who arrived in 64, 65, and they were, you know, wet behind the ears too, as it were. But by 67, 68, clearly things had changed.
Right. I was fortunate enough to see Ron Kovach, who wrote Born on the 4th of July. I saw him at Cooper Union. It must have been 80,
Ron,
I'm guessing.
Ron Kovach, I think, is the name.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It was a forum. It was 10 years after the war ended. So it was 85. The war, or 84, right? The war ended in 74?
April 75.
Okay, so it must have been 85. It was about 10 years when literature first started appearing about Vietnam. And there was Gil Noble, who does, what does he do? I forget. Like It Is. He was of course, a Time War correspondent, I believe, in Vietnam. I don't remember the poet that was there, a very famous man today. Can't think of him. But Kovach. Ron Kovach, yes, he was in a wheelchair. He was paralyzed from the waist down from machine gun bullets that did that. And he wrote the book, Born on the 4th of July, and he said give this book to all the kids and tell them not to do what I did.
Yeah.
So I was just very happy to be there at that time to see that. I'm reading Bel Air's Fugitive Life.
Oh yeah.
Days.
And I read it usually before I go to sleep at night, and sometimes I stop reading it because it's a little too scary.
By the way, I'm going to give can I give a shameless plug to someone else's book, Mark Rudd.
Oh yeah.
Mark's book is coming out in a few weeks. Mark will be in town at the end of March. There's an event up. I think it's either at Morningside Books or at the West End, on just opposite Columbia on Broadway, and then down at the Casher Gallery, I think in Midtown, there'll be an event toward the end of March. Mark's autobiography about Columbia and being in Weatherman is coming out.
Mm. What is the name of the book?
It's called Underground, I believe.
Oh. You're on the air. You're on the air. And you're on the air.
I think that guy that does the Indian, or pretends to be an American Indian, is very lonely. I don't think he has a life. But anyway, I knew Ted Gold back
in the day. But he has a dedication.
Yeah. Yes, he does, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I knew Ted Gold back in the late 60s. He came to the school that I was going to and taught history.
Really?
Yeah, the Adams School, ADAMS, on East 31st Street and 2nd Avenue. I forget what section of town that it is. And yeah, he was the first guy to hit me to the Communist Manifesto. It was one of the things he taught back then, was the Communist Manifesto, which I did not understand at all back then. You know, fortunately, I had my old man helped me out, because he was a former leftist when he was in his younger days.
I just want to tell people who don't know who Ted Gold is. Ted Gold was...
Don't let Ted Gold teach you how to make a bomb.
No,
No. That was an accident.
Mm. Yeah. I taught as a professor who still teaches up at Columbia, who was in no way supportive of the student action, but still to this day speaks of Ted Gold with great pride as having taught Ted.
He was brilliant and a really nice guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, he was the first person to turn me on to the Communist Manifesto.
I want to say something about that. I don't mean to disagree with you, Carl, but didn't Ted Gold's faction of the...
Weather Underground,
weren't they involved in an anti-personnel action?
Fort Dix?
Yeah, they were planning to put a bomb in an officer's candidate school dance or something like
that. Yes, they were. They were going to... They wanted to cause as much damage as possible because they believed, rightly or wrongly, I guess, that life in pig America, and especially among the middle class and the privileged class, could not go on as usual. If Bob, did you see the Weather Underground documentary?
Yes, I did.
Remember this scene where, I forget who it is, I think it's Bernadine Dorn, was talking about how they really felt that the weather people felt that life could not go on as usual, and there's like the birthday party, the scene of a birthday party in some middle class house. And I think they blow out, there's a birthday cake and candles, and they blow out the candles, and Bernadine Dorn's talking about, this is obscene. No, we cannot let this go on. Remember that scene?
Well, no, I don't remember that scene in particular, but I think people were at a loss about what to do. They could not stand the idea that they were... enjoying the protection of a country that was doing what the United States was doing to the people of Vietnam. And I think it was Gilbert who said, you go to sleep thinking of it. You wake up thinking of it.
Yes.
And it's with you every moment of your life, and you feel like to not do something is almost impossible.
Yeah, and when I finally came to consciousness in 1968, post-Chicago, I felt, especially after Kent State and Kenton Jackson State, I just had to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, I just couldn't, this cannot go on. You know, unfortunately, Kent State turned me into be a leftist, the radical, in Jackson State. Yeah, I agree with David Gilbert, and I think I'm really glad to see that there are things happening now, as if on the college campuses. You know, and solidarity. Also, I agree with Claudia, solidarity to the striking students at NYU if they're listening. And by the way, the students at the New School are planning another action on April 1st to try and get Bob Kerry to resign. There's an article in this issue of The Villager where they're talking about, they held a press conference where they literally they wore gorilla outfits, masks to hide their faces and their appearances. Like the Tupamaros or the Zapatistas. So there's a lot of stuff happening. This is not a period of apolitical college students, which I'm really happy to see.
Speaking as an alumnus of the New School, that settles it. I'm not going to give any more money if I had any.
Bill.
Yes.
By the way, do you remember, I think it was 2 months ago I asked you.
Lord Buckley.
Lord Buckley.
I know, I know. I'm working on it, Carl.
Do you have those two wraps?
I'll have to talk to you more about it, because I'm not sure which ones we're talking about.
My lords and my ladies of the royal court, we are joined by WJFF at this moment, broadcasting in Liberty, Grahamsville, and Jeffersonville, New York.
All right.
WJFF, we're also being heard on WBAI in New York City.
Broadcasting from the ass end of Wall Street.
And from KWMD in Kusilov, Alaska. And CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
But,
to
your lordship,
you mustn't interrupt me when I'm about to say World Wide Web. Okay. Now you can interrupt me.
Now, Bob, your lordship, as we're now talking about his ball swinging royal highness, his lordship, Lord Buckley, his birthday is coming up in April.
Yes, it is. It's
are you going to have Oliver Traeger on, your lordship?
Well, it might. These hours are a little tough for Oliver Traeger, he says, but I'll see what I can do. Perhaps I'll lean on him.
Okay. All right, I'll let you get another call.
We'll talk, Carl. I haven't got
good.
You.
Okay. All right, man. Later. Bye.
You're on the air.
Hello.
Wow. How are you?
Okay. Yes. Good enough. You know, if I stayed up long enough to catch you finally, because I figured the audience, who I love, every one of you, you'll miss hearing me. For those of you who don't know, this is Aaron Kay, the Yippie Pie Man.
I suspected as much.
Yes, and your suspicions proved correct. Well, I called in to emphasize my solidarity with Take Back NYU. You know, NYU has a lot of karma to work out, you know. Raping the neighborhood. Raping the East Village. And you know, they had me arrested once, too. Years back.
For felonious pieing?
For pieing William F. Buckley, and they banned me from the buildings for 6 years.
That's right. You didn't have a pieman's license.
No, I didn't. I was pieing without a permit. Mm-hmm. But then they had...
You were a privateer.
Yes, they also had one of our other people busted for a possession of a deadly rotten tomato. That was September 78.
That was Tomato Man.
Yes, Yes, AJ was Tomato Man, throwing a tomato which is meant for Richard Nixon, and the tomato instead hit the back of a cop's head. Nixon was giving a speech there at the dedication of the Pops Library. Kissinger was there too that day.
Was there anything thrown at him?
No, unfortunately. But the thing is, we demonstrators were positioned directly across the library, so we were able to see into the place, and they were able to hear us. Ironically enough, we could be heard by those people. You know, well, you know, whoever Captain Rosenthal from the.
How are you feeling, Aaron? You don't sound so good at the moment. You're staying up later than your usual couch time.
Okay, I don't want to say where I'm staying at because there's some roomies who I don't want knowing where I'm staying. I'm living on a couch someplace in the East Village. You know, I could use an apartment, you know. I can go up to four rooms, I can go up to about 800. And the thing is, it's rough because I went to work what they call a constructor eviction with two crazy roomies and a crummy landlord. You know, so basically I've been like in a homeless position these days, which I shouldn't have to be at this ripe young age of 59. Plus my physical problems don't help with it.
You are a respected anti-war veteran, Aaron, and you shouldn't be treated this way.
Hey,
there should be an anti-war veterans administration.
There's a lot of us who are in that position.
Yeah.
Hey, I was hanging with Ron Kovic in Denver this past summer during the Democratic Convention. I was out there protesting, you know, with the war policy, and also thanking. They say we're supposed to be thanking Obama for coming out for marijuana, because hopefully his choice for drugs are will pull through. This guy, we got his name, but he's the police chief of Seattle, and he's pro-medical marijuana. Now, Seattle has a pretty good policy on medical marijuana. Let's hope that his choice goes through in this matter. But then I went to St. Paul to partake in Republican, and I got sick, and I had to sit it out. My leg developed an infection. I couldn't partake in it. Plus, the police up there try to make it into a mini version of Chicago. We even have a St. Paul 8, St. Paul RNC 8, 8 defendants. They've been charged with rioting in this case, and they need help because they're facing a lot of time. I mean, but then the cops and the feds had their coterie of snitches and rats. We'll see what takes place. But currently, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening. But just wait till the flowers bloom. And believe me, with the flowers blooming, more protests will bloom on campuses.
The yeast is stirring and the bread is rising, is that what you say?
Let's just say the energy is there. The energy is waiting to happen. I mean, look at New School. I even went out in a cab with my physical pain to give a speech outside the New School to support the students. And I wasn't in pretty good shape today. I would have gone out to NYU to do the same thing. But I do support those people at NYU. NYU is a bigger villain than the New School in the neighborhood, you know. Driving people out of their homes, thanks to urban rescrewal, you know, and crotch rot.
Well, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you because they knew of a vacant apartment, how could they do that?
I can give my email.
All right, go ahead.
Pieman420 @gmail.com. I'll give it to you again.
Pieman420@gmail.com. Got it.
Or if they really want to try, go to yippiemuseum.org. There's a phone number in there for yippiemuseum.org.
the guitar reached me through that also.
Okay, Aaron, thanks, and thanks, talk to you soon.
I see.
You're on the air.
There are two postings that may be updates.
Go ahead, I'll read them.
It's from the URL, takebacknyu.com, and it's dated February 20th. I hope it refers to today rather than 24 hours ago. I'll read two of them, actually. The first one is student reinforcements storm third floor. At least 30 to 40 more students just stormed the third floor of Kimmel, pushing past the guards who tried to trap them in the stairway. Students on the inside forced open the doors of the dining hall, pushing against numerous guards, and pulled the reinforcements through the blockade and into the dining hall. The students of Take Back NYU are not giving in. We are only growing stronger. We demand negotiations now. That's the first post. The second one, also dated February 20th. I don't know the chronology of the two, but this one is titled Midnight Rally. We really need you here. The NYU administration has told us we need to leave by 1 a.m. or we will be officially trespassing. We are expecting a confrontation with security and or police. We really need you now more than ever. Please get everyone outside for a giant rally at 12 midnight tonight. The more people there are outside, the less likely it is that NYU will call in the police to drag us out. If you can, please print and distribute this flyer. Well, we've just done that.
Is there an NYU radio station?
Yes, there is.
And what's the frequency?
What's the frequency, Kenneth? It's at the low end of the dial. I think that. Like nine.
I'm going to stop up there after I leave here.
Going to what?
I'll stop up. I'll take a walk up to Washington Square after I leave here.
You're on the air.
Hey,
hello.
Bob.
Good morning.
Tai Chi guy from Jersey City. Listen, I read poetry once a month in Symposia Bookstore, and, my Tai Chi helps me with the poetry. And it's Symposia Bookstore in Hoboken on Washington Street, the main drag there. But let me tell you, everything is apolitical today as far as poetry goes in New Jersey. You know, they have middle-class values, these guys, and it's unbelievable.
Well, I thought apolitical was that chimpanzee. Ape political, you get it?
They put the poets through drills right about an apple. You know, it's like unbelievable, man.
Well, you should get to NYU and read some of your Tai Chi poetry there.
I wrote one tonight about the effect of Muhammad. During the course of the poem, I wrote about Muhammad Ali. I started out writing about the Pakistanis and their Muslim influence on the mixed ethnic community that I live in, you know? The Pakistanis at the newsstand, you know? Everybody frequents there, plays the lottery and stuff, you know?
I guess that you're hinting that you'd like to read it?
No.
Okay.
No.
Let's hear it. Come on.
Okay, I can live with that. You should go to NYU and read your poetry there and teach them some Tai Chi.
I tried Bleecker Street, you know, that bar, the back fence, and they weren't open at 3 in the afternoon, and it was unbelievable, man. They had no schedule.
Well, go to NYU.
Bleecker Street, right next door.
Take care.
Maybe if they're listening, they'll get their act together, you know?
Take care.
The back fence was the first bar I went to in the village on Christmas break 64.
You're on the air.
Still there.
Hi, Bob.
This is Wavy Gravy.
Hey.
You recognize my vibration of carbon.
Footprint, yeah.
There's a note on my foot. It's a footnote. It says, "Hello, Cement Apple. You have some gravy in your devices."
Well, Wavy, you know, there's something going on at NYU, which was the site of one of your historic appearances in New York City. Right now, there are students who are seizing buildings and presenting demands.
My.
Wow.
It was I, along with my expanded family mobile hallucination called the Hog Farm, who successfully, though unwittingly, warp the floor of the Loeb Student Center with chocolate pudding, maybe 40 years ago.
That's the same building, isn't the Loeb? Didn't the Loeb Student Center become the Kimmel?
The Ops.
What? Why are they doing this? What upset them?
Well, there are about 13 demands, and you can probably look them up online. Oh, you're not computerized at the moment.
No, not only am I not computerized, I've just got shot up with cortisone in a surgical procedure, and I'm laying down in a semi-glazed state, and was just calling you to give a shout out for the memorial celebration for Odetta that I am flying into the cement apple for, which is going to be Tuesday night. I'm sure everybody knows about it already at the Riverside Church.
7 o'clock on Tuesday night. At
yeah,
Riverside.
But the doors open at 6, and if I were you, I'd get there at 6 if you want to, because there's just so many amazing people that are going to get up and spill their heart song in about 3 minutes before somebody else has to come out and do it. But everybody from Maya Angelou to Harry Belafonte to David Amram to Steve Earle, holy moly. And I'm flying in. I'm only going to be there. I'm flying in on Monday and coming back here on Wednesday because I got stuff on my plate. But for the great Big O, who was ascended to, as Kinky Freeman says, stepped on a rainbow and went to Jesus. I'm there. I'm so there. And who else is going to be there? Sweet Honey and the Rock and Pete Seeger is going to be there. And who wouldn't be there? I mean, they should try and, how are they going to fit all those people in the Riverside Church, which is located it's uptown. It's on the west side.
It's by Columbia.
It's 400 Riverside Drive at 121st Street. There you have it. And what are the demands, Bob?
Well, do you have the demands? Can you read them?
I'll have to get the page again.
Give me the ballpark demands. What happened?
Well, the first one, and this one seems to make the most sense, is that there shall be no punishment by the university for the students and the people who are making these demands. Amnesty and the rights of some people who have been deleted from the staff.
Oh.
They want more public access to the library. They want community access to the library.
They want to feel less like an island.
They also
in the middle of the community.
NYU financial information to be made public.
And keep the damn tuition down.
And keep tuition fees down.
Oh, that's a good demand. The library thing, can't you just walk in and look at books?
Well, you know, a friend of mine lives on Thompson Street, and I think for a minimal fee he has access to the library. But maybe they want free access to the library. I do know that local people that live in the neighborhood can get access to the library if they can prove where they live.
Maybe they're withdrawing that.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. It would be terrible because... Yeah,
well. NYU has done some terrible things to the Greenwich Village area there in the last couple of years. They tried to destroy Edgar Allan Poe's old Poe House. And
I thought he lived in, like, Baltimore.
No, he lived near NYU.
Also.
Yeah.
Isn't there Edgar Allan Poe Way somewhere? I keep on walking. That's uptown, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And he also was parking some children, chicklets, little chicklets, Ted Jones used to call them.
Poor man.
Ted Jones.
He sure could spin a rhyme.
He was very rhythmic.
And
Ted Jones, the poet.
Yes.
I met him in Paris years ago.
Yes.
He used to talk about chiclets. When I was at NYU, we were driving around the country in buses. This was in the mid '60s, and we wanted some foundation to give us money to continue our mobile hallucination, and so we sent out a bunch of requests to foundations and invited them all to a show called Meet the Pudding at the Loeb Student Center, and we had a huge vat of chocolate pudding, and we were giving everybody spoons to feed each other. This was our communal message. We had a movie and stuff like that, and the Up Against the Wall Mother Bleepers invited the whole Lower East Side, and next thing you know, people are, well, pudding is flying all over the place, and I hear this, and I look around, and this guy is covered with pudding from his fontanelle to his navel, and he grabs the mic. He says, "I've seen the bottom of the pudding." And the pig couldn't get traction. We were traveling with a giant hog named Pegasus that we later ran for president, the first female black and white candidate for that high office. And she was skidding all over the place. And but we stayed and cleaned up. We actually cleaned the place up, except we couldn't get Free Puerto Rico off the wall.
Hey, Wavy, whatever became of Pegasus? Did she wind up as dinner?
I want to tell you, she winded up as a Christmas dinner for hippies while we were, we had gone to drive two buses from London to the Himalayas, bringing food and medical supplies to Tibetan refugees as a byproduct of that great adventure. And some hippies had pulled into our ranch in New Mexico and ate the pig for Christmas, didn't even save me a football. I had promised her that she could die of old age, and then I wanted to, instead of stuffing her, I wanted to hollow her out, kind of, but make her kind of stiff with a little slit on her back, so and wheels on her feet, so I could take her to events and garner funds for various causes. And it would have been wonderful. She would have made a great football even, but no, they just ate her up and never to be seen again. One guy, his name is Blonde Steve. Anybody who knows the whereabouts of Blonde Steve, meet me at the back of the Riverside Church for a reward.
What an ignominious end to a presidential candidate.
I know.
And a potential piggy bank.
I know, and she got a... Let's see, and other names, Joffrey Holder, the Holmes brothers, Maria Muldaur is going out there with Marie Knight, Emery Joseph, who just made a killer rendition of my song, Basic Human Needs, and he's got, like, everybody from Dr. John and Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown, everybody singing on it, and also he's just recorded Maria Muldaur and Bobby Weir, and that's to go for the credits on my Wavy Gravy movie, which is premiering at the South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, whenever that is. But I'm very excited about April. That. And Odetta is in my movie, too. And I'm going to be at her memorial. Because she was a great soul, and had a great sense of humor too. When she did her last performances, which was at an event here in the Bay Area called Strictly Hardly Bluegrass, and everybody from Emmylou Harris to Elvis Costello, and Detta was in a wheelchair. We were in charge of her, actually, for the weekend, and various members of my collective, mostly my wife Jahanara, and me, and Lila, and various other hog farmers were dead attenders, and she wanted me to be on the other side of the stage when she did her set, and of course I agreed. don't say no to Detta. And she rode up in a little elevator onto the stage, and I'm sitting like I was supposed to with my fish on a leash, or maybe I had the platypus. I can't remember. But I do remember vividly she started to sing This Little Light of Mine and got extremely irked with the audience at not singing along loud and well enough. And I noticed somebody was sitting next to me, and in fact, I heard this voice, "Do you mind if I sit down here?" And I said, no, it's okay. And I'm singing This Little Light, and suddenly I started to sound really good. I mean, I was sounding great. And I looked around, and who was sitting next to me was Emmylou Harris. I was singing This Little Light of Mine with Emmylou Harris and Odetta, one of the great musical joys of my life. It was like, what was it like? It was unlike anything. There, I do not have language.
Well said.
I think the cortisone is racing through my bones, Bob. I hope to see you at the Riverside Church. I'm getting signals that I'm well past my nighty time, and I have to collapse. But I suck your face through the holes in the plastic. In fact, all of New York. See you in church.
Eres la flor de las flores, eres rosa entre las rosas, eres la que estimo y amo, eres tú la más hermosa. Eres más apetecible que el fresco de la mañana, y más hermosa y más bella que rosa de abril temprana. Llamo puerta, a tu ventana, ventana, a tu madre jardinera y a ti, rosita temprana.
Andito usted en la fiesta tocando el verano.
Dios me da vida y rosa.
I told you that we were going to have Leonard Cohen and Leonard Peltier on the program this morning. And it depends upon whether I can get the DVD player to work or not. But we'll...
Promise at dawn. was the morning after. You were Jesus Christ, my Lord. I was the moneylender. You were the sensitive woman. I was the very Reverend Freud. You were the manual orgasm. I was the dirty little boy. And is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghosts of you and me. Is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghosts of you and me. You are Marlon Brando. I was Steve McQueen. You were KY Jelly. I was Vaseline. You were the father of modern medicine. Yeah, I was Mr. Clean. You were the whore and the beast of Babylon. I was Rin Tin Tin. And is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghost of you and me. And is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghost of you and me. You got old and wrinkled. I stayed 17. You lusted after so many. I lay here with one. You defied your solitude. I came through alone. You said you could never love me. I undid your gown. And is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghost of you and me. And is this what you wanted? To live in a house that is haunted by the ghost of you and me. I mean, this is what you wanted. To live in a house that is haunted by the ghost of you and me. That's right, is this what you wanted? To live in a house.
Well, you're listening to WBAI in New York City, and we are a listener-sponsored radio station, which is to say we're not actually asking you for money at this moment, but you can go to WBAI.org, and if you thread your way through our website, you might find a little button that says donate, and if you do, we thank you, and if you did, we thank you, and if you don't, will disappear. But we're here now, and we will be here until 3:30 this morning, broadcasting on WBAI in New York, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. And I do have a message from Leonard Peltier.
And to plant seeds in someone's minds, even subliminally, is an inappropriate and irresponsible act, especially for paper with the circulation that the New York Post has.
Anything I haven't asked you you'd like to add?
No.
Well, I'm sorry to say that, of course, it is an irresponsible act for the New York Post. But our irresponsibility here at WBAI extends to not being able to play a DVD on the air. Maybe it's possible, but I've never been instructed how to do it. So I can't do it. I apologize to the people who prepared the DVD. But we can't do it. And you're on the radio. You're on the radio. Hello? You're on the radio. No, that's not the, you're on the radio.
What is this program? Group therapy for armchair revolutionaries?
Yes.
Get up, wimps!
Yes, do you feel any better? You're on the radio.
Good evening, Bob. New Mexico calling.
Oh, hi. Good morning, New Mexico.
Hi, good morning. I love that guy. I know people don't like that, but I think he's great. Anyway, is Mr. Cronin still in there?
Yes, he is.
He is. Well, it's been an education. I've been reading for the last couple hours about Peter Whitehead's life, and I'm wondering where Mr. Cronin went to school.
Where did I go to school? Am
yes.
I on? You
can hear me. I went to school in England. Oh, and in England, yes. England.
I was reading that Mr. Whitehead was at Cambridge, and I was wondering, like, where you got interested in what you're doing now.
Well, I got interested in the 68 thing in part because of Peter. Yeah,
right.
I met Peter at a screening of his film, The Fall, which is the film that was shot in part inside the occupied buildings at Columbia in 68. That screening was about nearly 10 years ago now. I should say I wasn't even born in 1968, you know. So so Peter is living history to me. He's an extraordinary guy. Peter Whitehead he was inside MAF filming. He has this extraordinarily beautiful footage that he filmed of the students protesting at Columbia. And he gave me everything. I have all his outtakes and everything. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, he's really, it's fascinating. Are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, I spoke to him a couple nights ago. I mean, I made 2 3.5-hour films about Peter. And I'm actually working with him to try to publish. And if we can't get someone to publish it, we'll just do it ourselves. He kept a very detailed diary of his times in the States between October 67 and June 68. It's extraordinary. It's a true document of its time. So we're talking about trying to edit it for publication. But no, Peter's in pretty good shape. Interestingly, as I'm sure you've read, after The Fall, he essentially stopped making films. He's just finishing a new film.
Really?
The first time in 40 years, yeah.
Who's taking care of the birds?
Oh, well, the birds, unfortunately, met a sticky end, I'm afraid. Well, throughout the 70s, he was basically wandering the world breeding falcons, and then in the 80s, in Saudi Arabia breeding falcons and left in 91 when the Gulf War started and essentially had to abandon his birds. It was either him or the birds, and he just left them. Unfortunately, a few months after he got back to London, he had a massive heart attack and nearly died. But it's still going strong at the age of 72.
Wow.
And what happened was when I made the film in about two and a half years ago, we took it to the Vienna Film Festival. And he became so... Peter and five of his daughters showed up. It's kind of amazing. And he got so taken with Vienna and he was treated so nicely that he decided he was going to move to Vienna, which he did the next year, and make a film there, which he's done. So when I saw him in London a few weeks ago and he was editing the film. He is an amazing man.
Well, that's wonderful. I just had two other questions. We're talking here about a truth commission on the Bush administration, and I'm just wondering if there's any talk over in England, how you see Tony Blair and what you think of the Downing Street memo, if I don't know if you're political about any of that, but we don't hear any news about whether anyone's pursuing anything with Blair.
I must be honest with you, I haven't really been to Britain for any period of time for a few years now, for a good couple of years. So all I can tell you is that I remember being back in England, I forget when, but I got a phone call, just a canvassing phone call from the Labour Party, and I was asked, will you be voting for us? I think it was a local council election. And I said to this guy on the phone, I said, I really have an awful lot of trouble voting for the Labour Party now after Iraq. And there was a pause on the line. He said, we've been hearing an awful lot of that. So Tony Blair is certainly not the most... is he working as a Middle East envoy now, I think, for Gordon Brown, something like that?
Right. Peace in the Middle East.
That says it's awfully difficult to vote for the Conservative Party.
Oddly enough.
One can't really vote for the Conservative Party in Britain. So it's a lesser of two evils, really.
Okay, well, I don't want to take up any more time. I'd love to know your thoughts on Hunter Thompson here.
I'd be honest with you, funnily enough, Hunter Thompson's widow is actually a student at Columbia, and I talked to her last semester. But I have no view on Hunter Thompson. I can't claim to know his work that well. I was never that attracted to it. I went through a period, as many of us probably did, of reading a lot of the sorts of things. I mean, Hunter Thompson and, you know, Alfred Leslie was here, and I sat and read all the Jack Kerouac. But I have to be honest with you, all my William Burroughs and Kerouac and Hunter Thompson books are all piled up in the back of a closet. The Ginsberg ones I pulled out again.
Uh-huh.
I find Ginsberg very interesting, especially the Columbia connection made a lot of sense to me to go back and revisit Ginsberg. But I can't claim to be any kind of expert on Hunter S. Thompson, I'm afraid.
Or even have
any kind of informed view on the man.
Well, I have a very close friend who was very good friends with Mr. Ginsberg, and I'll send you. You gave your information earlier?
Yeah, my email is pauljcronin at gmail.
Okay, I'm sure he'd love to talk to you, and you'd love to talk to him.
Great, thank you very much. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Calling.
Have a great night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're on the air. You are on the radio.
Todd, I know what it takes to be cool.
You're on the radio. And you're on the radio. And you. Hello?
Yeah, I got some useful information. I got cut off earlier.
Terminated.
Terminated.
Let go.
What?
Accessed.
I have the emails and telephone numbers for the provost and president of NYU. They want people to write in, so I thought I'd give those out over the air.
Wonderful. Let's hear them.
Oh, I see. I'm on the air. Okay. The president of NYU's name is John Sexton. John, like J-O-H-N, and Sexton, like the poet, S-E-X-T-O-N. And his email is johnsexton@nyu.edu. And his telephone number is 212-998-6840. I assume that's during business hours. If people could tie up those telephone lines, that would be good. 212-998-6840. And then there's...
You better give that number again, Cloudy.
212-998-6840 of President John Sexton at NYU. There's also the office of the provost with a telephone number 212-998-2415 and the email provost@nyu.edu. They have a model letter, but basically the notion is that you're demanding that the NYU negotiate in good faith and not with the threat of punishment and arrest and so forth and prosecution hanging over the students' heads. Apparently they have reiterated their threat, even as they were negotiating, of arrest and expulsion, for those that didn't leave before 1 a.m. That time has already passed, and I don't know what's happened since then, whether they've tried to break in as they were starting negotiations or what. Because that's the most recent update.
Thank you, Clay. You're on the air.
The SDS is the...
You're on the air. And it's you. Hello.
And I'm going to be high.
And you're on the air. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. And we checked back from last night. Oh, something low on the radio here. Around 11 o'clock I was watching NBC, and it was interesting that they were stressing about lowering the tuition. And that's one angle that's really not being pointed out, is that the tuition of NYU is perhaps one of the most expensive in the country. And they're taking over the city. They have so much money. But the recession is really what's really responsible for a lot of this, because the people, the parents of the NYU students now are being hit with money. The NYU, when they first started expanding, the students had so much disposable income, it was fueling things like all the Starbucks stores and things. And now, since their allowance has been cut, they've been closing up these expensive coffee shops. You can see all these vacant stores all over the East Village from what they can't afford. So it was interesting because they were stressing about that, about opening up the books and looking at the tuition. Another thing, The Villager is really becoming a fantastic paper. There's the articles mentioned before about the new school. And other things, if they can just hire some underground cartoonists, it could be like a renaissance of the East Village or that. It would be something that you should have some people up from the Villager newspaper up, because they're really becoming a terrific newspaper. Hello?
Yes, yes. We'll check it out, Carrie.
Okay. I'll let you get another call.
Right. And you're on the air. And it's you.
Howard Fast was denied access to Queens College when I went there prior to this Columbia situation. He wrote Spartacus, A Citizen Tom Kane, Payne, and Freedom Road, amongst other books. So he wrote maybe 60 or 80 books. Hello, Bob?
Yeah, right.
And the point I wanted to make is the administration of Queens College, because Howard Fast was a progressive and a liberal, was banned from coming to a room at Queens College to talk about the nature of the world and his authorships and so forth. And we went down to the main gate to meet him, to, you know, welcome him, and yet we never were, you know, went into the campus. And even so, people rode by in their cars, you know, pro-administration people, pro-establishment people, and were blowing their horns, making it almost impossible to hear the poor man. So, unfortunately, he died a year or so ago, maybe two now. And he's a great author. You know, the movie Spartacus was based, with Kirk Douglas, was based on the book that he wrote. I don't believe he wrote the screenplay.
The screenplay was written
by Dalton Trumbo.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Under
right,
a pseudonym.
So,
that was the film that broke the blackness, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Might say protest, the Dalton Trumbo. Johnny Got Your Gun, and
he's
what
right.
A torturous performance it was on WBAI of this poor chap who's he's barely alive. His brain is almost all that exists from a war. And there's so many people dying and getting killed and the maiming, and yet we're in the most advanced society in our world that ever existed. Now, you know, with the computer, with medical advances and so forth, the point I wanted to get to is...
I was wondering.
Huh? Well, no, Bob, stop it, will you? The point I wanted to get to is the sense of exploitation. In the older days, that was a concept of capitalism, to exploit. In other words, you got to make profit, and then even profit on people who have helped you to make the profit, and you fire them. So, because of the computer and all these other aspects. So, the work that Paul Cronin and other people, Mark Rudd, and I wanted to bring up Mario Savio's name. Maybe you can access that and play his protest against the machine, because...
Well, we're going to try one more time to play the Leonard Peltier section that we have. Could be...
It's paused. Well, that was recorded into the DVD, I think. Let's try and pause it. Yeah, it's just jumping around. Too bad you can't see it.
Yeah, it's beautiful, it's, but it's...
Yeah.
Not to be heard. Well, we tried again.
Oh,
gee, and we had to cut Monroe off to... Darn. To put it on.
It's moving. Is there sound?
No, it's not.
Oh.
It's not. What?
Struggle
try
for
to
freedom.
Take it back now. Try
the man for justice.
I think that's where the sound begins.
That's Lynn Stewart.
So
but if we back it up,
what
we might
the
be able to.
At stake?
I think the sound begins there.
We have such a funky system
frame
here.
Frame the issues.
And it's an old. It's a DVD player, which is a combination VCR. Home variety, and it's hooked up to play through our console. And if you back it up, I might be able to get it.
That's where the recording begins, actually, the sound begins.
The issues that lie behind for so many years, Leonard Peltier's struggle for freedom, the demand for justice. What are the issues so long covered up? What were the issues at stake at Wounded Knee? At Pine Ridge. And I think there's no one really better able to explain these issues, even from a personal and from a direct point of view, than Teokasin Ghost Horse, who is a member of the Lakota Nation and from Pine Ridge.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's really an honor to be able to explain from one Lakota perspective as mine. I don't speak for all Lakota. I speak for my experience as a Lakota going through that time when I was a young, very young man, a young teenager at the time, and experiencing what I saw and what I thought was a normal way to be and live and act and to be always afraid all the time, which has affected my people the rest of their lives. It wasn't until like 12 years ago, 13, maybe 15 years ago, I was able to stand up in front of people. And
please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WB.
It's to pay attention to those things that we might have missed in our history books, you know, something that we have missed, a text that was written by somebody else who didn't want us to be here, especially as an indigenous person standing in front of you explaining our situation, even to this day. Right now, Leonard has been in jail 10,986 days, 19 hours, and 14 minutes, and 37 seconds. That's a long time. I mean, I was a young man when all this came down. And I living in Pine Ridge at that time with my aunt, who lived in the Indian Health Service or Health Hospital there, the old hospital on the hill in Pine Ridge. And my aunt happened to be a supporter of the American Indian Movement as much as my relatives were, who lived down in Northridge, an area that got shot up by the goons, the Goon Squad, guardians of the Oglala Nation, non-traditional Native people who were basically against anything because they would receive benefits if they went with the government, BIA, and especially with the church missionary schools. And people don't realize that the missionary schools and the Bureau of Indian Affairs went hand in hand. There was no difference. And being a third generation boarding school survivor as I am, I bring that to you because it didn't stop in the 1800s. It didn't stop in the early 1900s. It stopped. They closed the last boarding school in 1978 on the reservation to that dished out corporal punishment. Boarding schools still exist, but they are watched very closely because the mental, physical, spiritual, and sexual abuse happened to every one of us. And there are approximately about 300,000 of us, 50 years or more probably, and most of my classmates aren't here today to speak up because they are 6 feet under. They died of the fears. One of the things, you'll hear it in the documentary coming up, Incident Oglala, and they're talking about the poison to the land, a mindset that we didn't know because, of course, we didn't have the word for cancer. We didn't have the word for pollution. And we didn't know how to tackle this disease, I guess you would say. And we didn't have these ills in our society. Not that we were a dream society or utopia, but we didn't have the ills that we suffer now. Our lifespan was 120 years old because of the way we lived, the way we ate, and the way we looked at life. Because in Lakota, you do not have the concept of death. Now imagine that. Everything is alive all the time. So you don't fear, you don't have those irresponsible words or concepts like an uncle of mine says, guilt, sin, blame, fear, hope. You don't need them because that's what keeps him in death, in the throes of fearing to die. So you always try to remain young. And if we think about this, this way changed the whole people in the Lakota Nation. I promised to tell this story from a friend that I grew up in Bishop Hare, which was on the Rosebud Lakota Reservation in South Dakota, Lemoyne La Pointe. And it was Episcopalian dormitory in a dormitory boarding school. And he said, you know, I got to go into the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon. And he said, it's really funny how they have the highest banner flying, the pennant that says that it was a victory. And he said the highest pennant in that room is what we as Lakota consider a massacre called Wounded Knee. Well, the United States government, the Army, consider this a victory. So they have it flying. And they also gave out 24 medals of honor to the 7th Cavalry, who murdered 350 people. And my involvement goes back because my last name, Ghost Horse, comes from a survivor of that time. In 1890, my great-grandmother, her name was Ellis Ghost Horse Woman. And the reason why I received her name is because she never shut up, basically. She would always speak up and tell the truth no matter what. But she remained 13 years old at that time. And the next morning she ran, and she was very small for her age. And she ran to the stronghold. The next morning she arrived at the stronghold, which was a one-way in and one-way out natural bridge on a mesa. She got there, and the people noticed that this 13-year-old child's hair all turned all white. And she never grew after that. But she had a full-grown family. Her people, her daughters and sons grew to be normal. But she was always odd in the sense that she never sat in chairs or ate on tables, because she would always spread out a blanket in honor of her mother and father, who didn't survive that day in Wounded Knee because the Gatling guns and the Hotchkiss guns opened up on them. So she saw her parents leave. And so Leonard talks about sacrificing for 30 years. And he talks about it's nothing compared to what our ancestors did to give up this land. Now, I'm not here to ask for your pity or your sorrow, because I don't think you would get any place with that. You know, I'm not here to point out that this nation or these people did this to us. What's upon us now is a war that we can't understand. And that war, as Leonard says, and as myself would say as an indigenous person connected with that indigenous voice of the earth, is that there is a war going on against Mother Earth. And we're so much into paying attention to what's happening to humans on humans, against humans. And that's very arrogant. Because in that destruction, we are destroying Earth more than we know. And, you know, and if you look at it that way, the thinking that we have to do to impress something, some kind of change here in the United States, in all over the world, is in South Dakota, and some of you have heard that, it's the first state to totally, almost totally, a near total abortion ban. A couple of days ago, I think Amy Goodman announced almost a total abortion ban. So they're coming back. In this state, the atmosphere of racism is so acceptable that you don't know it's happening until it's happened to you. A few years ago, I took some New Yorkers out to South Dakota, and we stopped in a place called Corn Palace. And we stopped there, and immediately they would hear, they would see, and they knew, and they were appalled at the racism. Now, we don't like to say that word because we don't want to put up with it. When somebody is racist to me or to an indigenous person, to another person of color, what I say, are you hurting? Are you sick today? Are you feeling okay today? So when those secret societies come against Native people, they try to lie as much as they can because they're getting away with it. We Native people know that your president has been lying. Your system has been lying to you all along. And there's a reason why Leonard had 600 FBI agents, 500 in D.C., 100 in El Paso, march against him. The first and only time in this country's history. There must be something terribly secretive. Not only to knowing that the land contains, in some movies, in some documentaries, you see 50 to 70% of this energy, this land, the 2%, 2.5% land that we as Native people still live on, 70%, up to 70% of this land's untapped natural energy resource is on that 2% land. So that you can keep lights, gas, anything else moving. So we know what the future may be for us indigenous people. And this is a warning. This is a cry for help. And Leonard is that proverbial boy. He's got his finger in the dike. And if he's out, then so-called it's going to hit the fan. And I think it really has already, but we just haven't smelled it. It really has. And we've got the Patriot Act coming. We've got so much coming down against you, eminent domain, everything. The seven deadly sins at home, we call them the seven major crimes act against Native people. Because each one of those laws are to deride and erode our rights as human beings and as Native Americans, because we are the only people and Mike Kuzma can correct me on this, the only people that are noted in the Constitution, the only people. So I, for one, as a Native person, I have this T-shirt, and I told people this the other day, I have this T-shirt that says, I am America's first terrorist. And someone said, why? Why do you want to, they're going to check you out again. Well, the Staten Island Ferry, they do it like twice a week anyway. So I just give up my bag to go for it. Finally, they just give up. And I wore this T-shirt, and they were looking at me and said, it means you're a terrorist, right? And I says, well, according to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, I'm a terrorist. So we know what this is all about. And growing up, I don't want to say that this is a bad situation for me as an indigenous person, but I'm trying to figure out a way I can be able to bring the spirit back into this movement. It's not about being activist. I cannot be about activists anymore, because we can put titles and expert PhDs behind our names and in front of our names and go to here and that, and nothing really changes. I want you all to start becoming activators. It's a big difference. And that big difference is in the thinking. I'm going to explain it before I let the next speaker come up. And it's a simple thinking, and you've heard it before. None of what I said here is new. I plagiarized everybody from Columbus to whoever, but it needs to be said. And I know I speak a language that I haven't mastered yet, but someday I will. And those of you who need to go report, beware that when I learn this foreign language called English, I'm going to be one dangerous warrior. I just wanted to say that and thank the people that showed up. You all to show up tonight and pay attention to indigenous voices, because we got Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez, and we got more indigenous people coming. It is in our prophecies that the indigenous spirit is awakened now. And I think that you all are getting ahead of the game by paying attention to that. It's not, we're not saying go back to where you came from. We're trying to say respect where you're at now, and that hasn't happened yet. And we are going to show you the way as indigenous people, because we know how to do it on this side of the planet. And I'd like to honor some people that are here today. I know Ramsey Clark is on his way, if he's not here already. And Lynn Stewart, who just arrived. I'd like to thank him.
Spring of 83 that A.J. Stinson said to me, I say, young man, I want you to go and follow this herd down to Mexico. It was in the merry month of May I started for Texas, far away through rain and snow. Was a lonesome go as the herd rolled on into Mexico. It was in the spring time of the year we started out to drive them steers. I left my darling gal behind. She said, sweetheart, you're only mine. Her caress was soft and her kiss was sweet, saying we'll get married next time we meet. Through rain and snow, 'twas a lonesome go as the herd rolled on down to Mexico. When I arrived in Mexico, I wanted my girl, but I could not go. So I sent a letter to my dear, but not a word. For a year did I hear, well, I started back to my once-loved home. I asked for the gal I'd called my own. They said she'd married a richer life. Therefore, wild cowboy, find another wife.
oh buddy, please stay at home. Don't be forever on the roam. There's many a gal more true than I, so pray don't go where the bullets fly. Well, damn your gold and the bullets too. God pity a woman who can't prove true. I'm heading back where the bullets fly, and stay on the trail till the day I die.
Come back up again and really frame the issues that lie behind for so many years Leonard Peltier's struggle for freedom, the demand for justice. What are the issues so long covered up? What were the issues at stake at Wounded Knee, at Pine Ridge? And I think there's no one really better able to explain these issues, even from a personal and from a direct point of view, than Teokesen Ghost Horse, who is a member of the Lakota Nation and from Pine Ridge.
Thousand got drowned.
Using the term activator rather than activist in welcoming a really heroic warrior who we have to keep out of the prison system.
Yeah.
We have to not allow them to lay hold of Lee Stewart. I think everyone is with me on this. This is a real honor, and I'm going to ask everybody to stand and demand freedom and drop the charges for Lynn Stewart. And I hope that Lynn will be able to say a few words, but I'm going to ask Reverend Eddie Lopez, who was a longtime community activist and very much a real force of her defense committee, to say a few words first on Lynn's case, and then Lynn will hear from you, is that right?
I'm not really here. I'm a mere shadow of myself, but I could not ever pass up an opportunity to celebrate Leonard Peltier, one of the great warriors, one of the brave ones. And I know we're all here for the same reason, to get this innocent man out of jail. By any means necessary. I didn't say that. I'm going to let Eddie Lopez do the talking. He's of my defense committee, and I'm going to attend events for the next couple of months, but I'm not going to do much speaking or traveling around, and I guess you all know the reason. If not, listen to Wake Up Call tomorrow. I'm going to be on there for a little bit, and but this is just another fight against another insidious enemy. I think it's probably a lesser enemy than the cancer that is our government. Thank you.
great crowd. There's hope for America when 30 years after our government has disappeared someone, a crowd like this could still turn out. And if we are prevail, that's how. When we stop turning out, we might as well turn in. In August of 1966, I was trying to complete a sweep of visiting all the federal penitentiaries in the United States. We're getting close. A smaller prison in a place called Segalville, Texas. It's August, and hot as blazes. I was deputy attorney general. I became attorney general about 2 months later. And the warden was walking me across one of the yards. And up against the building, sitting on the ground, in the sun, enough to kill you. The white-haired man kind of slumped over like a Diego Rivera's painting. I walked over and leaned down, pat him on the back, said something like, "Hey, fellow, what are you sitting out in the sun for?" And he looked up, and his face and eyes were complete blank. I turned to the warden and said, What's this man doing here? Meaning in the sun. And he said two things of great importance to what U.S. prisons are and what U.S. police agencies are. First, he said, "We've been trying to get rid of you for years." That's the human value put on this man, the human dignity they accord him. So, but every time we make a move, a note comes back from J. Edgar Hoover, and it says, "Anyone who is convicted of killing a Federal Bureau of Investigation agent will never leave prison alive." This man had been convicted in 1924 of participating in a bank robbery in Oklahoma. And 40 years later, senile, he was in prison. I will say that when the FBI learned I'd been there and learned that conversation, he was released to a nursing home pretty quickly. But Leonard Peltier is in prison today because of that psychology. And the psychology is the slogan that Hoover had for the FBI. You always protect the Bureau. In every way, every day, you protect the Bureau. That's your mission, first and foremost. It's like the military force protection. You go into Haiti, it doesn't matter how many Haitians you kill in the process, you protect the troops. And unless we can break that attitude, we'll remain to the degree that we are now, a police state, where the police are above the law, and where you flood the prisons with people who could make enormous contributions to our welfare. There were fewer than 19,000 federal prisons in 66. The next year, we put a moratorium on prison construction. A big fight with a lot of Congress people and construction companies. But every time you build a prison, you commit a generation of maybe two or three, generally young men, to a very miserable and human, dehumanizing experience. Today we have more than eight times the prison population at the federal level, more than 10 times the prison population
at a state level. And more than 2 million prisoners in the United States. And people don't even think about it. It's one of the great assaults on humanity of modern times. In California, better than 35% of the African-American males between 17 and 27, which is a pretty vital age, are in prison for a felony conviction or on parole supervision following completion of a prison sentence for a felony conviction. Unbelievable. For the third of your basketball team, you know. And anybody that believes that they're there for our safety, it's got it wrong. It's just like Iraq. We are creating terrorism by what we do in Iraq, and we're manufacturing crime by what we do in prisons. We're controlling the crime. The Leonard Peltier case in courts is one of the most unique odysseys in our judicial history, and more needs to be known about it. It's been up and down like a yo-yo, and every time something else, very much like all these documents that we haven't read yet, we reveal, comes out that shows that there was no case against Leonard Peltier. You remember he was brought back from Canada because a young Indian woman who had been alcoholic for several years, named Myrtle Poorbear, signed two or three affidavits, none consistent with the other, that were used to extradite him from Canada. And they were proven to be utterly false. She claimed she saw Leonard do the shooting. She claimed she'd been married to him and half a dozen other things. None of it was true. None of it had any basis in fact whatsoever. And the FBI knew it perfectly well. And, on one of the appeals in the Eighth Circuit, 37 members of the Canadian Parliament sent a protest to the court saying that they would oppose any extradition to the United States while we submitted false affidavits to try to bring people back here. And they've been pretty good on death penalty cases, although they have extradited some people. We found early on that the ballistics evidence from what was allegedly the only AR-15 that the native people had on the on the reservation was false and known to be false. And yet it was a major element in his conviction. The first trial of four other people who were supposed to have been there, Leonard was in Canada, resulted in acquittals. What the FBI knew was it had to convict someone. If you don't solve the case in which two FBI agents have been killed, what kind of investigative agency are you? And Leonard was the fall guy. And one of the arguments that I had in the Eighth Circuit is, things like this never happen. The government attorney who was arguing the case was the chief prosecutor. He was the assistant U.S. attorney who had tried the case. And he admitted to the court that we don't know who shot the agents. We don't know who shot them. And here's Leonard, all these years, still in prison. He's known internationally far more than he's known here. It's incredible. There's a time when more than 10 million people in Russia signed petitions for his release. And one of those might have been activism or activators, but they signed. And the White House hated to see those truckloads of when petitions come in. We've had the same sort of truckloads for petitions for clemency, which we thought we were going to get a time or two and thought we'd been promised once from the White House. And it didn't come through because when the chips were down, you could pardon a few rich guys who had done some pretty bad things. But you couldn't defy the FBI on Leonard Peltier. Leonard's a very special human being. He comes from 250, 300 million people on Earth who were born and grew up where their people had lived throughout known history in that area, the Aboriginal people, as we often call them, a huge population, at least a quarter of a billion people. They are universally the most endangered of the human species. It doesn't matter whether in a country like Sweden, which has an advanced welfare program, laps, they're endangered. No matter whether they're islanders in Japan or Central Islands of Japan, the Philippines, or the African native tribes. You know, I don't know who gets it worse than Rwanda. It's not the Tutsis, the Hutus, it's the Twas. They were there when the dock when the Mayflower arrived in Rwanda. And he represents those people in a unique way. But his power of communication is enormous, which makes him singularly dangerous as an adversary of the state. Lumia is a powerful adversary of the state because of his pen and his voice. And the state wants to crush him for it. Lynn Stewart, because of her nobility, and because of her absolute courage. Talk about Mother Teresa. Because of her commitment to truth, whatever the consequences, represents that group. But Leonard's paintings are powerful. I have one that speaks volumes. It's just it's a print given to me by friends at the IAC. It's called Big Mountain Lady. And it's a face and a head, a whole head. The face is, the strength of the face is just beautiful. It's not like these plastic faces that you see at movie awards events. It's a real face. The hair is gray, steel gray, and the you feel like you can pat the hair and feel its coarseness and the strength of its fiber. She's a big mountain lady, and she was a very famous Navajo Indian leader. He died just several years ago, who often came to New York and often spoke out for Leonard. And he had seen her about 8 years before he painted the picture. They were all at Big Mountain. Big Mountain is in Four Corners on the Arizona side, before Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona come together. And she was sitting on the ground, and there's a tear coming down. And you look at the painting, and you taste its salt. And they're there because the Federal Bureau of Mines has just been authorized to engage in open-face mining on a mountain that for thousands of years had been a holy mountain, a religious site for the Indians of the whole Southwest, and now for the wealth of a few people and global warming, we're going to rape that soil.
I'd like to pause that. That's Ramsey Clark you're listening to. Just for time enough to give a station break, and you are listening to WBAI in New York City. We're at 99.5 FM, and we're also heard on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska. And we're also heard on time delay on Saturdays, I believe, at CJLY. Did I get that right? I should know by now. CJLY, yes, in Nelson, British Columbia. And WJFF in Jeffersonville. And we're streaming on the World Wide Web. And this is Ramsey Clark again speaking. Among the panel were Lynn Stewart, Ramsey Clark, Teal Ghost Horse, And if you want to call and perhaps you have some information about the NYU situation, our number here is 212-209-2900. And if you like what you hear, if you feel so inclined, I'm sure if you call or go to the website, www.wbai.org, there's a place to contribute. A small $25 contribution would be noticed and appreciated. Should I take a call now, or shall I go back to Ramsey Clark? Well, maybe somebody has something in the way of an update. Let's just see. Okay. Hello, BAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because there's a program in support of Leonard Peltier tomorrow evening.
Oh, well, you want to please give that information?
Yeah, it's. I'll just read it right off of the flyer I have. It says, Honoring the People's Struggle, an evening with David Hill of AIM, and he's the Leonard Peltier spokesperson. And there's music with David Lippman and the Mahina, I don't know the pronunciation, Mahina or Mahina movement. It's at the Judson Memorial Church from 6:30 to 9:30, which is at 239 Thompson Street. And it says, suggested donation, $5, nobody turned away.
Okay, I think we can get away with saying that. That's
okay.
Fine. Sure. Thank you very much. One more time.
Yeah. Which?
The whole thing.
The whole thing?
Yeah, I know it's at Judson, and I know it's tomorrow.
And it's from 6:30 to 9:30.
Okay.
And it's with David Hill of AIM, and he's a spokesperson for Leonard Peltier. And it's at Judson.
Great.
That's it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Let's go back to the tape. It's not a tape, it's a DVD.
That Corey place. The painting speaks volumes about the history of and struggle of a great genocide. The Indian people, the Native Americans in this society. And if we ever hope to redeem our character, we have to act now. The plight of the Native American is as demeaning and impoverished as it's ever been. You go to South Dakota and look at the prison population that's Native American, and you see it's a high multiple from the percentage of the Native population into the whole state. It's a pretty big percentage in and of itself. But that's the way you control the problem. You just put them in jail. We need to energize ourselves to insist upon, first, the breaking down of the code that somehow or other the punishment for the deaths of an FBI agent are different than for other people, that their lives are more valuable than the lives of other people. But until we learn the equality of every child, woman, and man on earth, and we'll be a dangerous and violent species. I wish we could hear from Leonard tonight. I hope you'll read his prison letters from Martin's Press has published. People like Desmond Tutu and people from all over the world have commented on the power of those words. So he not only paints, he writes. And as a human being, he communicates with near unprecedented force. We have to believe that we can change things. We have to recognize how dangerous our times are. A guy like President Bush can go to India without any indication to the American people or the international community that we're going to wipe out the non-proliferation treaty on nuclear weapons. We're going to create new tensions between China and India, between Pakistan and India, new alliances, new preparations for war, and destroy the struggle to eliminate weapons of mass destruction from the face of the earth, going on since at least 1968 when we were working in the department on the non-proliferation treaty. And we're helpless and hopeless. If we can't demand and effectively achieve
the release of a wrongfully convicted person who has served far longer in prison under far crueler conditions than should have been inflicted had he been guilty, though he wasn't. They were helpless people. And in the hypocrisy that governs, the 99.99% of the population that has the astronomical increase in its earnings every year, its income, billionaires make the decisions in this society to take us down. I hope our love for Leonard will be sufficient to free him. Free or not, we'll be repaid for the efforts many times over by his faith, by his art, and by his wife. Thank you.
And thank you, WJFF Fred Pecora, for preparing that tape for us. While we were listening to the applause, our minds flipped to another subject, and Paul had a reminiscence of Al Lewis that I asked him to share with you.
I never can't claim to have known the man. You want me to tell the Rodney King one?
Yeah.
I mean, I must have been 17 or something, some, I don't know, kid out of London, just fresh in New York. And the Rodney King riots hit in L.A. And then the next day here, there was some minor actions. And I remember we met in Times Square. We're walking down... walking down 6th Avenue, or maybe 7th. Anyway, ended up, and the police were kept on blocking us off, trying to block us, and they got some blocks, people, and, you know, trapped them in blocks, but we kind of ran free. I remember running into Madison Square Garden, I swear to God, running with a crowd into Madison Square Garden, and I'm tall, I mean, I was tall back then, but I'm this big melee in the foyer of Madison Square Gardens. And this, I'm running, and I'm trying to get away from two people who are beating each other up behind me. And I run smack into this just huge dude. I mean, he's huge. And he just stands there, and I bounce right off him and just fall onto the floor. Anyway, we then leave Madison Square Garden and just get all the way downtown and start walking through the West Village, where I seem to remember people start throwing things through shop fronts. And glass gets broken. And it gets a bit nasty. And we're walking down the street where... which street? Where Al's restaurant was.
It was a Bleecker Street.
Yeah, and 7th Avenue, just west of 7th.
That would make sense. So we're still on the west side. So we've walked downtown. And he knows that some shops have been smashed. And we're walking... And I have no... By the way, to me, this guy's Grandpa Munster, you know. I mean, what do I know? And I turn to... I'm walking in this crowd. It's a heated atmosphere. And I turn to my left, and there's Al standing in the doorway of his restaurant, just giving a big thumbs up to everyone. And everyone just cheers, go, yay, Grandpa Munster. And he knew exactly what he was doing. It was fantastic. And then, as I said, last year I watched, there was a film made about a GI that goes AWOL and hides out in the chapel on the Columbia campus. St. Paul. This is a little hour-long documentary. And he's there. Al is there in the chapel giving his support to the GI. It's great. It's very interesting. Anyway, so to me, Grandpa Munster is now a fully-fledged, you know, radical activist. Who knew? Who knew? I should take this one back home and tell people about it.
Thanks for that.
Well, I feel like I was very lucky to know him.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I was having some personal problems at the time, and he gave me a plaque that said, a friend is someone who heard you sing your song when you were young and reminds you of it when you're old. And it was just what I needed to hear.
Yeah.
And here's someone who's going to sing a Hopi chant for us. You're on the radio. No, he's gone. He's a drone. You're on the air.
What?
Yes, what is that?
Hi, is this WVRI?
Yes, yeah. It is.
How are you doing? I want to know if you could just give a shout-out to the students who are in solidarity for the NYU occupation. We're still in the street out here. I was wondering if you could just, shout us a word on the radio.
Well, you're on the radio right now. Tell us what's going on down there.
Our numbers are dwindling, so we kind of need more support. We don't know what the police are going to do. They might, enter the building and arrest the students. They gave them an ultimatum, but we waited them out. And, all bets are off for amnesty for the students indoors. And we don't want to have too small of a crowd on here because we're not sure what actions the administration and the police might take.
I'm going to head up there as soon as I leave this place.
Okay, cool, man. Well, I'll be here. We had about 300 people, and we charged the barricades and tried to charge the building. Things escalated, got somewhat violent, but, most of the protesters calmed everybody down, and it turned from a mob back into a demonstration. But the weather's cold, and we just really need to build our numbers. That's what we're trying to do right now.
First rule, don't hold a revolution during the winter, man. It's just too darn cold.
You know what? Whether
next time you'll know, all right? Next time. Yeah, next time during the summer.
I don't know, man. When the time calls, you got to take to the streets. So.
Is there a live webcam there by any chance? Because we saw some video earlier. I don't know whether it's been updated, though.
If you go to TakeBackMIU.com.
Right. Right.
There's a webcam on there. I think that's the only footage from inside. I mean, there's a lot of coverage outdoors tonight, but I'm not sure where that would be. I've been here all night, so I'm not sure what sources you'd be able to find in the video.
I was hoping there might be a live stream or something. That's why I ask.
Is there some way people can contact you now? Or are there numbers that people can call?
They can call my number if they need information or,
You want to give your cell phone number?
No. Sure. It's 845-784-8162.
All right. Someone take that down. I'm sure someone's going to call and ask us for it.
Give it again. 845.
784.
Yeah.
8162.
Okay. Bob, can I just ask you a question? Or not?
Sure.
No. Bob, actually, I wanted to talk to him. This thing I'm looking at is very funny because I'm looking at the thing on the wall that lists the FCC words that I'm not allowed to that we're not allowed to say. But I guess when I'm sitting, where I'm sitting,
it looks like it's a teleprompter.
I would never normally think about saying those words, but now I'm looking at them, I actually kind of want to say them.
You can't get them out of your mind. Yeah. Huh? You're obsessing with them.
Well,
see, there's a kind of a history to that poster. George Carlin did a wonderful poetic routine about the words that you never hear on the radio.
Which words are those?
And it was quite wonderful. And when we broadcast it, the FCC received a complaint, and we went to court, and we lost. And then, in a later time,
We won, but we had lost the lawyer fees and all the rest of it.
5-4 decision.
But the Carlin thing is he puts his finger on it so simply when he just says, like, they boiled it down to 7 words. The 7 worst words in the world. You say these, you'll go straight to hell.
Well, Carl even mentioned the last one being, it shouldn't even be on the list. It's kind of a friendly word.
You know what? Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, come on.
Hey, the cock crowed 3 times.
This guy is still, is the NYU guy still there?
Yeah, I said, we can't do that. You'll have to submit requests to each and every field office in America, which we did. So on November 1st, 2002, we submitted FOIA requests to every agency, every field office we hadn't already submitted requests to. And lo and behold, every field office in America, and there's 50-some-odd field offices, have records relating to Leonard Peltier or Resmers. All of these requests were sent to Washington for processing. Now, keep in mind, no appointments and records can be disclosed within 20 working days. We're still, here it is, what, 2006, we're still waiting for these records. But what we did do is, since there's only a handful of attorneys and limited resources, we decided to sue for the Minneapolis files, the Chicago files. We brought that lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota. We also, being that I'm based in Buffalo, we brought suit at the U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York. And as a result of these lawsuits, we learned that the government has 142,579 pages of material that have never been released to Leonard Peltier or his defense attorneys. And this is quite interesting, given the fact that at the time the government prosecuted Leonard Peltier in 1977, they had merely turned over 3,500 pages of material. So we're still... So it's just incredible. How can you say Leonard Peltier got a fair trial when they withheld close to 140,000 pages of material? Now, I would point out that the Freedom of Information Act contains various exemptions. There's a national security exemption. It's called the B1 exemption. There's a B7 exemption, which has various subparts. For example, B7A allows an agency to withhold information if it would interfere with an ongoing investigation. There's a B7D exemption, which relates to confidential sources. These exemptions are permissive. Merely because material falls within one of the exemptions doesn't mean that the agency...
My perspectives are broadened, my senses are dull. Phoning into the radio show. People stop to watch construction when it has something to offer. People stop to watch construction when it has nothing to offer. The structure's good and the night is beautiful. The connection is clear now. The volume's down low.
You're on the air.
Hi, Bob.
Well, there you are on the air. I thank you for that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that if you were trying to play the letter from Leonard, possibly either next week or maybe if Ibrahim would like to hear it over the phone. Just a very quick aside, and then some information. This date in history, 1725, 10 sleeping Indians scalped by soldiers in New England for scalp bounty. So I don't want to go into detail, but we're the ones that did the scalping. I just wanted to let folks know it was great
You remember what Tonto was supposed to have said to the Lone Ranger? When the Lone Ranger said that they're surrounding us, he said, "What do you mean us?"
Us. That's right.
So why do you say we?
Well, you know what the Indians call a someone who is a turncoat? They call them an apple because they're red on the outside and white on the inside. And I spoke to some of my Mohawk friends, being that they've taken me under their wing, and said, we're going to have, I asked them, I said, we're going to have to come up with a term for someone who's white and red inside, the reverse of the apple. But I just wanted to let you know and let folks know that on WJFF in a few weeks, on a program called Connections with Dick Reisling, Leonard's sister is supposed to be doing an interview either on the phone or hopefully in person. And maybe at that point I can ask her. His show is on a Monday at 7:30. But I'll give you a heads up when I know for sure when she's on. And possibly folks could tune in to WJFFradio.org. But as far as when Ramsey Clark was mentioning that they were close to getting a pardon with Bill Clinton for Leonard, I think that was wrongly put. I think we should ask Leonard to pardon us. I think that someone that's so wrongfully incarcerated for so long, we should apologize and make restitution. But and that evening, Ramsey had been in a car accident recently, so he that's why he was speaking a little softly. But he's got my respect. That's for sure. But thanks again, WBAI strikes again, and Radio Unnameable strikes again.
Oh, that might be a good idea. Take care.
Take care. Thank you.
You're on the air.
Hi, Bob.
Hello. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I have a strange personal anecdote. It was about 40 years ago around this time that I wandered into the Loeb Center there at NYU to get a sandwich and listen to some music. And a demonstration spontaneously took place where they locked the doors and I couldn't get out. And I didn't know what it was about. And Pete Seeger was on the intercom swearing, using language that would make a sailor blush, railing at the faculty of NYU, which I didn't quite understand. You know, I mean, I'm sure it was something, you know, that he seemed legitimate, but he was just sounded angry and drunk. And then they let the students out, including me, who had just wandered in, you know, who wanted to get out before the police came. So it was very puzzling. So I turned on the television, and it's 40 years later, and there's this demonstration going on in the same building, and I don't quite understand what it's about again. So if you want to elucidate, maybe you can enlighten me this time.
Did you ever get your sandwich?
Huh? Yeah, I did. But it's like I'm still clueless 40 years later.
Well, let's see. I don't know what the price of the sandwich was.
It was about a buck.
Well, it's probably a lot more than that now, and so is tuition.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that it's about.
They said they want to know where the money is going. It was something like that I heard on the TV, but they didn't really tell us much what they were demonstrating, what the thing was, you know.
Well, that's quite a bit right there, isn't it?
Well, it is.
You know,
because
the university has been poor mouthing. And as a, you know, it doesn't pay taxes, it doesn't let its teaching assistants organize. It's, you know, still living in the medieval scholars' times.
Okay, that I understand because I was an adjunct teacher at a number of colleges, and I used to call it, to my colleagues, academic sharecropping, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So if they're still doing that, yeah, it's...
And worse.
Yeah. And I know that, and I can, you know, being interested in animal rights, I know that they've done a lot of nefarious things at their laboratories down there with animals, and Pete has been yelling about them for years. So there you go. There's a few things going on. Well, okay.
Okay, is that enough for you?
Yeah, I think I'm getting the gist of it. But boy, $50,000 a year, I heard, is what the students pay, or if they're on scholarship, that's what they're getting out of them.
But they can't afford sandwiches with that, you see.
Huh?
They went in to get a sandwich. It's the same story all over again.
It's the same story all over again 40 years later. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Frank Black, horse. And with the American Indian Movement, they had used an individual by the name of Douglas Durham. He was a former police officer from Iowa, and he was actually sent into the American Indian Movement to infiltrate the group. And he had moved to a position of influence and power. He actually became head of security when, in fact, he was an FBI operative being paid $1,000 a month. But we're still fighting like hell to get these FBI files. We just done... February 24th got a setback in the Buffalo case, which we'll be appealing to the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit here in New York. And what I would suggest people in New York do is lobby their representatives in the House and Senate to liberate these FBI files. And in particular, locate that New York City file. Where is it? Why isn't it being released? So I think anything people can do in that regard would be most helpful, and there is precedent for that. The Boston Support Group, through Barney Frank, was quite successful in getting the headquarters filed.